deal with the more complex issues with this, when you're not changing numbers, you're just changing, giving effect to the other proposals, there's a lot of writing to do, and our legal team is busily trying to interpret what you said from a policy perspective are the changes that we want. So today, Chair, what we'll be doing, and I've circulated the documents that we have. We've got first just a presentation, but that's just a presentation on this document. I know we have a few more coming, most of you do have it, but I know members of the press still don't. We lower down the order. You will get it in about 10 minutes.
And we accept we also do.
Inshallah. Okay, we'll give you a copy. Okay. And then, Chair, just so that I alert you, the document does deal with the issue of the debt harmonization. But we will be dealing with that through last. We want to just deal with all these issues and then come back to the issue. There are some complexities there that we have to raise. So obviously, I think if we look at the first slide, it just lets you know that we received 52 comments. That we also then have workshops or meetings with people who have made submissions or people who feel have something to add. All of this house to develop the proposal. This year we did have different deadlines for Parliament. We tend to have slightly earlier deadline than the House on the website, because as you know, the bill is not published in Chair. Yesterday when we were asking about any money bill amendments, to see if to amend money bill, I think we must take into account the different approaches we take towards taxation as opposed to the expenditure side. So I just want to record that for you to consider. And obviously, so what we present today is just a draft document. I want to add, we don't ask the Minister for approval for that response, because the Minister wants to come in after, he's certainly familiar with the issues, but in terms of the process, we obviously want to take any further comments we receive today, and so the document you have, we call it a draft response document. What we then do is to publish a final one when the bill is tabled, so that you see the changes that have been finally, or the final response document of government as such. So that's just the process. Sorry? Taking the mic. Say.
As Momo is saying, the final version will be published when the bills are introduced. Last year, the bills were introduced during the MTPPF. But you want to say that this year the bills are not going to be introduced during the MTPPF. All the bills together with the two pieces will be introduced on the 27th of October.
I don't know. Yeah.
Why is that where we are?
So, Chair, part of it is a function of when this meeting takes place. It's the biggest factor. Because even if we get comments today and we have to make further changes, obviously we still work on the bill,
yeah.
But if we have to make further changes, it may take us a few more days, and then the state law advisor has to certify, and there's just too few days between now and the 21st, because obviously Parliament then has to publish, so the logistics makes it difficult. I think it helps if this meeting is at least a week earlier, then I think we could have made it for the 21st. So we now have to make it a week later. And of course it depends on when Parliament's sitting as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the 27th. But the other good news, Chair, which is not for today, is the Twin Peaks bill has been certified. I think it was yesterday. So
is 25th, and nobody's coming in to say Mr. Proficio. Well, I mean, you can come, but we won't be here. The second thing is, I really feel that, you know, I think we should just put this in our report entry. This idea that you come here on a Tuesday, the 12th, as it happens to be a 13th, was it the 12th, I can't recall, what is Tuesday? And the following Tuesday you vote on a BRRR that looks at National Trust, staff, and in our case three other entities, is utterly absurd. Utterly absurd, actually. And I really think we should protest quite vehemently about it. The MTGPS was supposed to be the following week. 2 weeks is reasonable. Even last year, we recall, we said it's not enough. I know justice said till 10 o'clock last night. They couldn't go 10 o'clock today. They will finish tomorrow at 1 o'clock. How are they going to vote on the report on Tuesday? This is not on. This is not on. And I think I'm looking for a mandate from this committee. I'd like to suggest that we put in our report, and I'll be mandated to raise this with the Speaker, Deputy Speaker, Chief Whip of the ANC, and everybody. This is just not acceptable. We can't do it, actually. It becomes like a farce. So, you know, what I'm saying, colleagues, is that can members apply their mind? If people aren't voted on it, I'll live with it. You know, and then don't complain about the quality of the report. Okay, over to you, Mohamed. So it's not only the parliamentary term, we have to have our constituency treated as well, as you know, but it's also on your side as the executive. You brought forward by 1 week the minister's MTBPS, and the original program was the following week. So, really, this is not on.
Okay, we'll convey that to our bosses, but...
No, I am already.
It's okay.
It's not here. It's the power that you parliament.
Yes.
It's coming in bigger, so it can't be done.
Yes. Anyway, I'll leave that to higher morphs to sort out. Okay, so the main issues that we deal with today are outlined here. The slide is not hard to read from here, but anyway. So firstly, we deal with the TLAB issues, the loopholes around estate duty. So what we're doing in this slide, Chair, is just to focus on the big issues. But as I've said, now that we all have hopefully copies of this, this goes into detail. We actually comment on all the proposals that we've got, and then provide a response, whether we accept it, we don't accept it, we partially accept it. I notice in our rush to get here, we should also just provide a full list of all the comments, just for the record, just the name of all the people who submitted, which is what we normally do. But Parliament does have that because it is submitted to you and it's part of the record, but I think we should just list it. We omitted that. So we are just going to highlight the big issues, as there's four issues. The other issues, the collateral transactions, issue around insurance, and the withdrawal of special foreign tax credits, the 6 quin issue that the subcommittee met yesterday. I don't know if the subcommittee has to report on that. Chair, okay, but and then we have the TLAB proposals, the tax admin, those issues, and certainly there were issues around R&D, so we'll sort of deal with all those issues in this presentation. Once we're done with this, Chair, we'll then just update you on the retirement reform issues that were approved last year. But Cecil, do you want to kick off?
Thanks, Thomas. So, members, Chair, the first issue was the estate duty and loopholes that we tried to deal with there. Just to give some background, we've made some amendments in 2006, 2008 and 2009. And there the maximum age on retirement annuities were abolished and the exemption for retirement funds into estate duty. what has happened then, people were putting in a lot of money into retirement annuities just before this was passed, and that resulted into a circumvention of the estate duty. The amendment that we've made was that this will become effective as from 1 January 2016 for everybody that passed away after that date. The concern that were raised was that this will have a retrospective impact, and the people that have acted in good faith in terms of the wording of the law would be negatively impacted. We've taken that into account, and then what we now propose is that it will apply to contributions on after the 1st of March 2015. So that's the, and this is in line with some of the recommendations by the Davis Tax Committee. Okay, so we will eliminate the issue of the prospectivity and do it as from the beginning of the tax year, just after the announcement of the budget. The second issue, Yanga, you want to deal with this?
The second issue deals with the tax relief for certain collateral arrangements. In the 2015 draft TILA, we introduced a relief in the form of deferral of both CGT and STT in respect of outright transfer of collateral, and provided that this transaction will be returned to the owner within a period of 12 months. I think during our workshops, we say what is the collateral and what is the amendment is doing. So, the taxpayers are also agreed that the limitation of the collateral arrangements to a period of 12 months without the ability to report is too restrictive. And then they are proposing that that limitation be withdrawn. Currently, we do not accept this proposal from the taxpayer because the proposed amendment is away from the common law principle in regard to a change of beneficial ownership. And the draft proposal in the 2015 TLEG is based on the two options that we discussed with the taxpayers in February this year after the budget, because we met with the taxpayers, we gave them the two options. And this is the preferred option that they prefer, that they chose from the two options that they gave them. So based on that, the 12-month period will be retained, because this limited risk period is important to ensure that the CGT system is not undermined. That is our response from that matter.
Right. I think we should look at the issues per issue rather than think the whole thing, what the members want to do. You wanted to go through the whole thing and then we come back to each issue. Can we be guided? What do members want? Hold it. And then we come back to each one. Okay.
The next amendment deals with the alignment of the tax treatment of insurance companies with the same initiative. In 2016, the new Insurance Act will come into force if it's passed by Parliament, and also the SSB will introduce the Solvency Assessment and Management System, which is called FAM Framework. As a result of these changes have been made in the Income Tax Act to align, because the regulatory requirement of the SSB will no longer be required to determine the taxable income of insurance companies, both long-term and short-term. As a result, in the 2016 TLEF, changes have been made to take into account of the proposed changes. We have met with the industry, that is the insurance industry, many times, and together with the SSB. Some of the proposals are partially accepted because we have a consensus regarding what needs to be done, and most of them are accepted, so there is no problem, I can say for now. The next amendment deals with the withdrawal of special foreign tax credits for services still sourced in South Africa. This was a comment that was heard orally in Parliament on the 16th of September. In 2011, the National Treasury introduced in the Income Tax Act a special foreign tax credit for services fees. This was against the international tax principles because we were giving a foreign tax credit for services being sourced in South Africa. And the policy rationale for doing that was to alleviate the compliance burden on South African taxpayers, because some of our tax-free countries in Africa were taxing the South African companies, not only the South African companies, but all the companies that they are doing business in those countries are taxed in the same manner that is against the principles of tax treaties. So in 2011, we introduced this special measure. It was an incentive. It's against the international tax principles. Okay, we have some of the taxpayers now are using the relief not for services fees, but for royalties and interest. And also, on the Debit Tax Committee report, Action 6, the interim report that was published last year, it is stated that the foreign tax credit for services fees, that is Section 16, is a base erosion resulting from South Africa giving away its tax base. That is, by giving this foreign tax credit, South Africa is giving away its tax base. So based on those, in 2015 draft TILAP, we have decided to repeal the foreign tax credit. And the taxpayers argue that the relief provided in terms of Section 16 mitigates for double taxation faced by the taxpayers in doing business in African countries, and it is an incentive to help make South Africa attractive as a regional service hub. Hence, the incentive should not be repealed. We understand the taxpayers in that regard, but we also view that we will still repeal Section 16. However, instead of giving a credit, we'll give a deduction. What we're going to do here is we're going to amend Section 6.1c so that taxpayers will all qualify for a tax deduction instead of a foreign tax credit in respect of foreign taxes paid on services fees sourced from African countries. That's what you propose to do.
Chair, the other issues that was raised during the briefing session or the hearing that the committee had was the issue of the RMD, which was not an amendment in the bill, but it was an issue that was sort of raised by some taxpayers, in particular KPMG. And in this slide, we just summarized the issues that they've raised. I think the subcommittee did discuss this yesterday. Just to provide some context to the R&D incentive, the Department of Science and Technology briefed this committee on the 4th of August on the progress to date on R&D. A few weeks thereafter, the minister have arranged a breakfast. That was an event that was raised earlier this year, but it was scheduled for the 21st of August. We wanted to make the point that in that briefing by KPMG, they didn't even acknowledge these particular two events, especially the one by the Minister of Trade, Science and Technology. The Minister there explained the objectives of this particular incentive and some of the concerns that were raised and some of the problems that were raised. So at that time already, these issues were acknowledged. The industry representative at the briefing meeting of the Minister indicated that in broad the incentive is a welcome initiative and in line with what is happening in other countries. Obviously some countries are more generous than others, but ours are probably in the ballpark figure. A couple of concerns were raised, which was really repeated in the KPMG presentation. And these issues were noted by the Minister of Science and Technology. The question of innovativeness being a bit high bar to jump over, the long delay in terms of processing, and the need for an interface, and the difficulty that SMEs have in accessing this particular incentive because it's a tax incentive and it's not a grant. So all of those things were acknowledged at some time. The Department of Science and Technology, indicated on this slide 14 some of the steps they are taking. Already they've announced at that point that they are introducing a new IT system, the new the guidelines will be published, and actually that was done in late September, and a couple of other issues, especially with respect to the ICT sector, and there they are planning a special event during November. At that briefing session with the Minister of Science and Technology, there was a suggestion from the floor that the Minister appoint a task team just to look at some of these issues, and she agreed to that. And so that particular task team will be formed within the next month or so, I think, and then the intention is that they complete their work within the first half of next year and report back to the Minister of Science and Technology, and we will have a look at it. It's important to note, Chair, that despite all of these difficulties, there has been a significant uptake of this particular incentive. And I think we don't hear the story always. In the tax expenditure report that we have published, the indication is that on average about 1 billion rand per year of this incentive resulted into revenue for GON. Those are the years that we've got good data for. And so there should have been some people that have benefited from this. So it should also be noted that the incentive is there to encourage additional R&D. It's not there to just help people to subsidize existing R&D, because then the incentive becomes useless exercise. And so although it's difficult to identify and quantify additionality, that has always been the objective of the incentive. It's not there merely to subsidize existing R&D. And I think one must be very careful to argue that all expenses, irrespective of the nature of the R&D, should automatically qualify. This is meant to be an encouragement of additionality and update. So, in short, Chair, some of the administrative difficulties during this transition period has been acknowledged, has been addressed, and the committee received feedback from the DSC and will receive feedback once the Minister has come up with a view on the recommendations from the staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator. just running through the key issues that were raised with respect to the tax administration rules and the full draft. The question of legal privilege. Essentially here, that the concern that was raised, well, first of all, from SARS's side, we often see question of legal privilege being raised, sometimes validly, not sometimes not. And the question is, how do you deal with that? What's the process? So the proposal was to bring forward a set of basic details about the documents or information that privilege is being claimed over, so that we could make a judgment call on it. Taxpayers were concerned that we were being overly inclusive about the details we were looking for. So what we did there was we went and looked at what some other countries are doing. We carefully looked at what we were asking for, and we restated it to make it as narrow as we possibly can whilst it being useful to us. There has been a suggestion that all we should do is refer this to some independent party and let the independent party look at it and come to a conclusion. The problem there is twofold. First of all, you'd obviously like to be able to deal with the question without having to go to someone else. SARS may well accept the claim of privilege over the document, and then that there's no need to take it any further. Second of all, and probably more importantly, if we have no idea of what these documents are about and we don't have the basic details about them, we have no idea whether the third party got it right or not. So there would be no basis for us to then wish to take it on review to a high court or take it on appeal if necessary. So the proposal here is, as I say, to narrow the information we're looking for to make sure it's as targeted as we can possibly make it and to deal with some of the technical issues. With respect to a reduced assessment, this was the case where currently a taxpayer can ask for a correction to their return if they restate their return and therefore their assessment in a 3-year period. We were observing that in the outer years the risk of inappropriate claims was rising dramatically, and that most people in fact had put their claims in within 6 months. And then with another peak at around the 1-year mark, which is understandable. When I look at this year's return, completing this year's return, I look at last year's. So there was a possibility of an extension. Commentators were quite unhappy about this one. They argued that it went against the flow of the move to self-assessment. And having considered this carefully, we think that that's a valid point. And so we'll be maintaining the three-year period. We'll obviously then have to beef up our risk approach with respect to the older returns, which means we'll have to give them additional scrutiny. But I think that's something taxpayers should be willing to live with. And then finally, to deal with another issue, which is people were trying to put more substantive matters through this rather than going through the proper objection and appeal process, we're making a small technical addition to it to say that it needs to be a readily apparent undisputed error. So it's something that requires essentially a deal of arguments or audits to get to a conclusion. It's probably not something that should be run through the system. This was probably the most contentious of them all. This is the discretion of the commissioner to extend the period within which an assessment may be issued. There were two legs to this. The one was in respect of cases where taxpayers were not giving us the information that we required, either simply not responding, or if they were responding, they were taking us into the question of privilege, our ability to access the information. And obviously, whilst that's happening, it's very difficult to audit if you don't have the information you're supposed to be auditing. So one aspect was to extend the prescription period for the period, a reasonable period to take account of that. And the second leg of this was in respect of complex matters, and we gave two, we said, general anti-avoidance rule or transfer pricing or similarly complex matters. Because you simply run out of time trying to understand some of these extremely complex structures. Members will recall from the workshop the slide I put up showing you one of those structures, which took us a significant period of time to unravel. The concern here then was, well, what's an appropriate period? What's a similarly complex matter? My complex might be your simple. And is the period we're extending for too long? So, obviously I'm speaking too long, the microphone is switched off. The point here is, this is a pretty targeted proposal. Some other jurisdictions would simply say for transfer pricing, say you have a longer period, whether SARS is auditing you or not. So here we think this is targeted, as I think we've stressed before, it's the commissioner who makes this decision or a very senior person at SARS, so this is not something that would be done lightly. And we've also take the point that we shouldn't be able to do this sort of the day before prescription expires, so what we will be proposing is that the notice has got to be given to the taxpayer either 30 days or 60 days in advance of when prescriptions otherwise happen, so that they have some warning of what's coming and they can preserve the relevant documents and so on. The question then is, how long is an appropriate period? So here what we'll be proposing is to say, well, it's got to approximate the delay. So if you delay for 27 days, well, then it's 30 days extension. If you delay for 31 days, it's probably still a 30-day extension. Then, with respect to what's a complex matter, okay, that was a fair proposition, so what we've done is gone and looked at what the complex matters really are, and we're listing four of them. So, doctrine of substance over form, that's the legal doctrine, the general anti-avoidance rule, which was one part of the original proposal, drawing from the base erosion and profit shifting reports, the taxation of hybrid entities with instruments, and then transfer pricing, because that's true. In looking at the period of extension, here we are proposing to stick with the 3 years for where SARS raises assessment, so the total period becomes six, and once you move to self-assessment, we are proposing a two-year extension, which brings you to seven. Why six or seven? We've given you some backgrounds to what some other jurisdictions are doing in this space. There are other jurisdictions that go higher than that, but we thought that to us in a reasonable space. Then one of the questions that was raised was around SARS's power to appoint a third party. Here, the proposal in the draft legislation was to provide a 72-hour notice period whilst a taxpayer would then be able to, well, essentially the person who was notified would preserve the asset, and the taxpayer would be given an opportunity to come to SARS to make whatever representation needed to be made. This was something that did not fly in favour with the banking industry. They thought their systems would need substantial updates to make this happen. Interestingly enough, other businesses thought, well, 72 hours is too short, so whilst the banks thought 72 hours was too long, others thought it was too short. So to cut that Gordian knot, the proposal now would be to essentially ensure that SARS gives people a notice, the final demand of payments, telling them what the consequences are of ignoring the final demand, and giving them the relief that they could get from SARS if they're not in a position to pay. So that then gives them an opportunity to come to SARS, say, right, I have a problem, I need more time to pay, or I can't pay you at all, I'm virtually insolvent, can we do something by way of compromise? So that gives people that opportunity. Obviously, if they ignore us, or if they simply don't qualify for those reliefs, then we would proceed to collect from the third party. There is a carve-out, which is present in other areas where SARS has collection powers, which is where you identify that, say, there's a risk of the person skipping the country or shedding assets as fast as they can. You don't give this sort of notice, and that exception is applied here. But again, here a senior SARS official has to explicitly take that decision not to issue the notice. Finally, just to wrap this one up, the comment was made that there should be judicial oversight over this. That, I think, loses sight of the distinction between civil debt and the statutory tax debt. And we've just given you a sense of what other countries do in this space. There's an OECD survey of 56 countries. 50 of them have this power. One of them requires people to exercise it. So SARS is very much in line with international practice.
Between the last time we met and now, apart from the meeting that Thiers convened yesterday, do you want to talk a bit more about the extent and the extent? So, because we're going to ask the representatives of the stakeholders to also speak in a moment, right? So what was the extent of consultation? And what's your sense about how far you pushed the gap? You have explained on each issue, but in general.
Yeah, Chair, I think we have meetings, but I want to emphasize that we obviously don't want to get into a negotiation or bargaining exercise with the tax advisory industry. So we do have to make a judgment call, and the consultations are limited. To the extent that we think that they have points, we might talk to them. But, you know, often a lot of the people who come, they are lobbying for a specific thing, and frankly they will only be happy if we give it to them. So that's what we do. But do you want to just outline some of the meetings that we had?
I raised with you over the phone another matter that affects a certain constituency, right? So we are acutely aware, acutely aware of what you're saying, but what you're simply saying is that I think we were struck, most of us, by the gap this time around, compared to last year. And we just feel that it's about engagement, not about conceding in a populist fashion. There's a difference. So all I'm saying is, if you have sufficient engagement, and it's meaningful, not nominal, then we fulfill our role. Ultimately, it's for us to hear them, hear you, look at the needs of the government, the needs of the country, and decide. That's what we're saying. We're not saying, we know that we'll never come to agreement. Then if we do that, we'll be, we should close down the country. That's the point, it won't function. Okay, over to you.
As Mohamed said, we consulted with the taxpayer. For instance, on the outside transfer of collateral, even before we drafted the deal, we met with them and we gave them the option. As Mohamed said, they had to make a judgment call. But we met with them, we gave them the options that we think are viable, and then they chose the option. Yes, they didn't like the option, but we met with them. And then, for instance, on that one, there was the first batch of the draft, which was published in May, and then we met with them again to make the changes. So on that one, and even on SAM, regulatory framework for insurance, we've met with the industry, consulted with them in terms of the drafting of the legislation. And at the moment said that we have to make a judgment call. And we've met with them also on other areas like the issue of share incentive schemes, we've called meetings. Yes, we have consulted widely with the industry, we've got all the data.
All right, fine. Can we move on then to... Has anybody raised any issue around the issue of compensation?
No. Okay, on the first issue, shall we go through it issue by issue, as we normally do? By closing the loophole that allowed for the circumvention, right, of trade duties, on this matter, I wonder if we shouldn't ask the stakeholders to comment on it, and then we engage. We have both sides, and now we take a decision. It's not as if we're going to sit here with an endless discussion. So do you want, what the members feel, shall we hear them and then engage? Because then it gives us a balanced view. We've explained that this is not politics per se, although tax are political issues. But it's not allowing, you know, the municipal systems, ward committees, or, you know, where, you know, as politicians, man, I don't know the technocrats can help us very much, but frankly, you need to edit them in that regard, right? But this is like very complex, very technical. So we want to hear both sides. And I think it's agreeable. Can we hear them? We'll give you about 15 minutes. You quickly go. Instead of taking over each issue, just give us your comments on the responses you've got for the engagements with Treasury and right now. Who's speaking on your behalf?
Is there people? I'm still here.
Ah, you're very hesitant to speak. It doesn't seem to be. Which is fine, make our task easier.
So, Chair, I'll speak on the matters affecting the Banking Association matters.
Yeah, we asked, by the way, for you guys to meet and set up a little joint structure to address all the issues. You never did that.
No.
Okay, fine. We've given you the opportunity. One more thing, Parliament, we cannot force you to cooperate. And frankly, you know what? If you lose out, what more can you ask? How many other parliaments in the world will do this, right? Yeah, but then you complain, we elitists, we take decisions, who are these politicians? What do they really know? Can they add and subtract? Well, we've given you the opportunity. You've had 6 or 8 weeks to meet together, which emphasizes the point Treasury and government and Parliament does, which is that you are more divided in some respect than you are amongst yourselves than you are with Treasury. But now you speak for the banking sector only. So these are the issues that affect you directly, the issues that your constituency and ask you to raise. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. So just an overall comment, thank you for taking a lot of our comments into account, we appreciate it. I think the foreign tax credit is welcome, and we look forward to that. We understand also the feedback on the Tax Administration Act amendments, such as the legal privilege, and we take note of the feedback from SARS there. Also, we welcome the compromise with SARS on the agent appointments and the collection of outstanding tax debt. That is really a significant matter for banks, so thank you for that. I think the only point that I do want to comment on, and that is where there are regulatory changes imposed on the industry, such as banks, which are highly regulated, what we do require is extensive consultation with both National Treasury and SARS for tax to be an enabler of that legislation. So what I mean by that, if we look at the collateral, and I do understand the comments that Younger made, our position is the tax position has evolved from what the peer tax principles are that we are currently dealing with. So for example, the South African Reserve Bank and National Treasury impose certain restrictions on banks where we need to hold high quality liquid assets, such as bonds, government bonds and listed bonds from large corporates. These instruments enable banks to meet the regulatory requirements imposed by both National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank. At the moment, the legislation, tax legislation, does not enable that for us to do it. It's highly punitive. So what we propose is to engage again with National Treasury and SARS with a view to the NHSC process for February next year to see if we can reach some agreement here that in terms can enable the legislation. We're not looking for an advantage, we're not looking for any avoidance here.
No,
we're just wanting to tax and the regulatory requirements to match other that the enablement of the legislation. So that is a big concern and the takeaway that I want to leave with this committee. Thank you, Chair.
That is the only issue on which you want to make representation.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And there's nobody else from the other. Are you here from another end?
Oh,
okay. I don't see that.
Thank you very much, Chair. Philip Baba from Representative Spiker. I think just one of the representatives we made was on the parliamentary on consultation process, and I think we'd like to thank Parliament for the fact that it has given us essentially an opportunity to respond. This is to the concern of us organizing. I think it's very difficult for industry bodies to suddenly, in 6 weeks, put together a, call it, single representation for 55 million people. I think that that is a bit of a stretch to fall.
I think it's disingenuous. We've also get together and have some structure that will represent the different interests, but in Parliament, and that's what we're saying. One, we are naive. You are dialectically opposed interests as well, because if we intersect into the one constituency, the other constituency will be the government. So we're not that naive. There wasn't any intention, but perhaps you are. Perhaps it's actually not possible even to set up a loose structure to which Parliament can engage, which we thought would be of benefit both to yourself and ourselves. Fine.
But thank you nonetheless for indulging us in that respect. Just as to the one matter which is section 6(1) regarding the credit, I think we are thankful for the fact that we are still getting it deduction. I think policy wise we all agree that there is some relief getting at least a deduction rather than a credit, even though we, I think the alternative to this, and I think something that we do need to explore further, is the fact that essentially the taxpayer in these certain factual circumstances is still out of pocket. And I think we still would need to get better engagement whereby we start enforcing the, or better enforcing the provisions of the DTAs, because it puts the taxpayer in a compromised position of now still forfeiting essentially 72% in cash of the taxes paid where there is something in agreement in that sense. As to the matters of reduced assessments, as noted, Southgate got a lot of feedback on that perspective, and I think adding in additional wording, I think I'm not sure where we'll have to see how that wraps up. I think undisputed error was to some extent starting to form some shape as to what that means, and the additional qualification will probably take some time. I think the extension, a further issue on the extension to issue assessments, one of the proposals as noted that was made is that the extension mirror whatever SARS field has been the period that the taxpayer has not been cooperative. This has still gone a lot wider than that and does still provide quite a substantial increase in the time period which the taxpayer will sit without certainty. The whole idea of prescription is to bring some certainty within the tax system in that respect. I think just as a last comment on the agency appointments, I think the whole debt recovery system, I think, was one of the comments we made. It's probably something that we've seen both the courts making comments on. We've now seen on several matters courts questioning the constitutionality of circumventing the judicial process or judicial oversight. And I think even if you look at the comments made or the court tabled by the tax ombuds and the systemic matters that he has, in fact, a lot of it does deal with matters like objection in the appeal time period, refunds, etc., which to a large extent will tie in with the whole system of commissions.
Anybody else from the stakeholders who want to share that? Okay. So we'll come to your issues. We'll get to what you said, what they said. And we also have time, Zumutani and
he's also great on that. He will guide us, as will Peter Paul.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You are the end of this, but we're dealing with the issues sequentially, so it's a bit easier. Yeah, fine. Okay, guys, let's move to the first one. Can I just apologize for using my SMS so much? I don't think it's good when you're sharing to do so much of SMS, and it's not good. I had a problem. with about 7 minutes to 10 on a thing I submitted, and the photograph, they wanted it in JPEG and so on, and the deadline is now 10 o'clock. They just discovered they can't use the photos. So I have to find different people to assist me to get the photo out. It's not a private matter, it's a political matter. You're not just an MP, you're first and foremost a political activist. So you have to do these things. So the article was submitted, was accepted, and now at 7 minutes to 10, the guy comes and says he can't use a photograph. So without a photograph, the article has no meaning. So I have to desperately try 5 different people to locate the person. I don't know how these things are done. It's a Samsung, it could be sent on iPhone, and it's converted from that into JPEG. And so I was very busy doing that. But I'm listening, and remember, I'm going to be reading this thing very carefully, this text, and I've got Sister Sultanasani and so on, study group and portfolio committee. So I apologize for that. Doesn't mean I don't take very seriously these issues. In fact, I'm more challenged, as Ismail knows, by these issues than I am other issues in the finance portfolio, because they are so technically difficult for me at least, and I'm just for the energy. Okay. Now, let's see with the first issue there. Now, colleagues, we are looking at the closing of the loopholes that allow for the circumvention of the state duty. Now, what do members want to say about that? I think my colleague hangs up. Good.
Sure. No, I just wanted to get clarity on the relationship between the closing of the loopholes to allow for the circumvention of the state duty and the current moratorium on the modernization of the modernization and the registration process of the agency. Is there any relationship between the two? Are they related or are they not related? Because, basically that's what I would like to establish first.
I don't think they're related. No, the one is a legislative amendment that we picked up. The other one is just a process of SARS trying to bring the estate duty administration into in line with an electronic version. So, SARS. So they're not related. No.
You're looking for me. Is there something you want to say?
No, you know, Chair, I'm just thinking about the loopholes, whether we actually understand those specific loopholes that we are trying to address.
Mm.
Because loopholes are not necessarily just legislative. They may be process-related, they may be simple-related. I don't know what kind of loopholes that we are talking about here. And probably one might need a clarity on this one, so that we are on the same wavelength on this level.
Yeah, these are dealt with the last time we came, but remember, even myself, I'm not complaining, it's about us as MPs, you don't understand our culture.
Yes.
It's hard to remember, actually.
Okay, maybe I'll
actually, you know, it's funny, she's reading, I'm also trying to look at my notes, my last notes, and I've learned it on my bloody iPad, and my
you like an advocate.
Sorry?
You like an advocate. You apply your mind during the brief, obviously.
Yeah, but the thing is that you see, I go to get what's that thing called for you? What the other people use? What's that thing where you use your iPad, your phone, the same thing? What's it called? No, iCloud, the other one, the blue one I've got.
Dropbox.
When you use Dropbox, it doesn't. Yeah, and I'm irritated because I realize my iPad's gone dead. Okay, so I'll do my homework. You got 2 weeks. Don't worry, I'll do it. She's right. You will say what we told you guys 2 weeks ago, right? 4 weeks ago. Hey, a million other documents are over there.
We can repeat it.
Yeah. And this is Parliament, and you will convince us. So please repeat it simply. Yeah.
Look, it's really simple in this particular case. What has happened is that in 2009, I think, we made a change where we're saying that your retirement savings, when you die, all your effort goes into the estate and the estate is tax. But there are certain of your assets don't go to the estate. For example, if you take out an insurance policy and you've got a direct beneficiary, that doesn't go into the estate. Previously, your retirement savings was part of your estate. It was taxed in the estate. In 2009, we made an amendment to say your retirement savings, the cumulative savings, will not be part of the estate. So you get that relief. What has happened is that a lot of people then pushed a lot of money into the retirement savings space in order circumvent the estate duty. And we said, look, we didn't anticipate that the release should be so generous. It should be a reasonable savings pool that you build up in retirement should be exempt, not all your savings that you now artificially channel into retirement savings.
And you can do it one day before you die.
No.
Is anybody else going to comment on this? Can I raise something? At this stage, we need to get some technical advice from our independent researcher. So we're not going to take any decisions anyway, the bill is through. But tentatively, I don't know what the members feel, but I think this is reasonable. And would we have a problem with it? I don't know. Are there any problems we can see? I mean, one time to say is, these are all tentative thoughts, right? Nothing is binding, because we need to think these things through, right? We foolhardy for us to take decisions. But tentatively, let me put it that way, for now, for what it's worth, what's our view on this? So we don't come back to, like, endless discussions. What do you say, this?
Thank you, Chair. I think in our deliberations, we also looked at the issue of drawing the line between avoided and stage. And we think this intervention, of course, we limit that space where people in moral avoid pain. So we are more comfortable with this.
Really deeply philosophical.
So we really support it because it was meant, of course, to help some of these in moral problems.
No, no, I can't see any problem with it. But
obviously, I'm not an expert. So I think this tentatively we're saying yes to, right?
Yeah. Check.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I want us to check when is the effective date, because one of the issues that is raised here is that it may affect, you know, other taxpayers who did it under the old regime. How far do we go? And how are we managing that situation?
Well, that's the main change that we're proposing.
Yeah, first of March.
So it's from the 1st of March.
Okay, so anything before then won't be okay. No, that's fine. Then I'm
are you reading something about yourself?
Yeah?
Are you reading something about yourself or somebody?
No, okay. I'm just presenting you. You are more great than I am.
I'm not giving you something. I'm not giving you something. I raised your bed. I need to brief you about something. Just remind me. Okay, so that one tentatively will be fine. Unless we get some. Do you want to speak at this stage? Or
I think we just covered two chapters today.
Yeah, so you're right.
One of the key issues, the effective state.
Okay, so you're okay with it?
Did the board want to say anything?
No.
Chairman, you're not talking this
one. Oh, sorry, indeed. Sorry,
thank you.
You're not David, you can speak.
I'm glad I'm the favourite son. Chairman, I understand what we're trying to do here, but I know that these are very brief notes, and these are more complex, and I'm trying to find in here. But what I'm having difficulty just getting around is that what we're trying to prevent is someone the day before they're dying say, oh, they know they're dying, but it's taking their last savings and putting them into retirement. And so now we're saying that the change will apply after the 1st of March 2015. So if I had done it before the 20th of that day, it's okay. Yeah. Okay. So after the 1st of March 2015, then any contributions to retirement funding again are included in the estate. Is that what we said?
It's only the contributions that you can't deduct. So it's excess contributions. So the normal contributions will be okay. It's only excessive contributions that will be denied.
All right. Are you happy?
Yeah. We'll give you some water. The next item.
The next item is on the tax relief for certain collateral arrangements. don't know if the members may have a view or a different view on how the matter has been handled. So, Michel Seder is proposing us to look at that.
Chair, maybe at this stage we might actually ask them to tell us how do they feel, how does this enable them? Because I heard you saying, you know, the what is being proposed is going to disenable you from actually facilitating this process. And maybe we need to get more clarity on that, because I need to reconcile what National Treasury is putting here and what your concerns are.
Yeah, I have a good question.
Thank you. The first point to make is the proposals by National Treasury as they stand now are welcomed by the whole industry and accepted. So we're very happy with the proposals. However, the proposals at the moment only deal with exemptions as regards to the outright of transfer of collateral of listed securities, shares in other words.
Yes.
Now in the banking industry, the quality of your security is very important. Now a listed share ranks much lower than a government bond, for example, or a listed bond of a corporate, which you can much easier turn into cash. Now, in the banking industry, cash is key as the best form of security. Now, as the proposals with Basel III, the high quality liquid assets, and the net stable funding ratio, I apologize, these are complex terms, but my colleagues in Treasury would be familiar with that. As these concepts get introduced to regulate banks more and to have more stable capital, we need longer term collateral arrangements. So for example, if we lend out money for 4 years to a large corporate and we ask for security in the form of bonds being pledged to us, that is fine, that's what we currently do. But we can't do anything with those bonds if they're just pledged to us. By allowing the outright transfer of that collateral, banks can use that much more effectively, and it qualifies then for the Basel III requirement to enable us to have that better capital position and a more secure and that is the decision that we are saying. So we're very happy with that. We would like to see the bonds extended to other instruments such as listed government bonds and listed corporate debt. And then the second point is the term. 12 months is very restrictive for us because with the banking regulations, we require long-term stable funding and not short-term deposits. So if you are allowed to post your collateral for much longer than 12 months, say a 5-year term, then you've got a much stronger position from a capital perspective because your lending is much more secure for that longer term. We don't mind turning the collateral and replacing it in a period of 12 months for tracking purposes and to make sure that there is not avoidance. We were very happy to work with Treasury also on proposals to prevent abuse or avoidance with that. Because you can understand if somebody keeps on lending you something, you will never realize the tax. But we mustn't forget, in a banking environment, your original loan transaction still has all the full tax consequences. Currently, if we pledge something, there are no tax consequences for a pledge. The same, we proposing the same should be for collateral arrangements with the outright transfer of collateral. Sure, that's clarifies it.
Sure. I wanted to hear what National Treasury, what the National Treasury with the extension. Raised by Bata, the extension to other like bonds. Currently, bonds, the relief provided by this is Securities Transfer Tax and CGT. Currently, bonds do not attract Securities Transfer Tax. So, the only issue that they may attract is capital gains tax, but not that much because bond yields interest and interest is very possible. So that issue we discussed with them during the meeting, and it was clear that the issue of CGT may not be that too much of an impact on bonds, because SCT, they don't attract SCT bonds. So the SCT is off, the issue may be the CGT. But it may not be that much because bonds, they yield interest and interest is fully taxable. Secondly, with regards to the limitation of 12 months, currently we've got a legislation of lending arrangements which has got 12 month limitation. So what we are doing here is to say, okay, we gave them two options. The first option was that if you are one business, the first option was if you can give you securities perpetual forever, not limited. But if you want CGT, then the limitation of both CGT and STT was 12 months. So those are the options we gave them, because the issue here is that the outright transfer of collateral is like you transfer your beneficial ownership, and it's against the principles of common law, then there should be a CGT. So we said only for 12 months. So that is the main issue here, is the period which is 12 months, of which they want to allow reporting. So we said, no, I think maybe just we can add.
I think you should raise it. I mean, if CGT is an issue for bonds, I think we can probably accommodate that. We just have to look at it. Where we're sitting, we thought it was not a big issue, but if it is an issue, we can accommodate it. I think the 12-month period is more important for us, to the extent that one can come up with entry avoidance measures to extend the period, we can look at it, but not for this year. That's for later period.
So, Chair, just as a way forward, I think what we'll do is, look, I think as Bartha said, I think the whole area of you know, the impact of Basel on banks and so on. We'll meet with them to discuss solutions along the way suggested, but just to ensure that we've looked at this properly, because I also want to just get our sort of prudential team that's involved, so we can so we'll have a meeting when we. By the time we come for the final call, we'll... Yeah.
Well, I think you're entirely right to say this can't be a bargaining chain. And you can never have equality in taxes. And we agree with that. But you see how, by encouraging a bit of dialogue, you pick up things. I mean, I think you do very good work overall.
Yeah.
But I also think they are not just representing simply their narrow interests and where they are. They're also raising some other issues. So you see, you pick things up. And that's what Parliament should do, because our aim is to encourage, at least a minimum degree of consensus around these issues. Good. So, Makoti, I really like the way you intervene. It's nice. You know, you raise the question. See, you prompted now progress on this issue. I think it really struck me when you spoke, and it's important to ask. So I really thank you for that, Makoti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some clarity in terms of the legislation and the amendment. Does that mean then that one can every 12 months enter into a new loan agreement? So one could say to a client today, "Well, we're going to give you this money for 5 years, but in order to do that, we have to enter into a new agreement every year. We have a separate agreement."
And that's typically you must have an open position which you need to close out. Otherwise, somebody sold shares on a short position and they need to go and borrow shares to close out that position. No problem with that, and you will regularly open and close those positions. And that is very much on the broking side and the trading side on the JSE that facilitates that. On the banking side, where we why we require longer periods is because our lending transactions is a lot longer, where we require collateral to be posted as security for those lending transactions. So if we lend money or we enter into such transactions financing long-term projects, we require security for a longer period, and that's why we require a longer than 12-month period for that. I trust that.
Yeah.
Jim, and I understand that one wants a longer period and you need the collateral, but what this is doing is shutting it down to 12 months. So So if you want to give someone a loan for 5 years, then in order to do that, you have to renew that collateral every year. Is that possible?
So, Jim, maybe just to interject, at the moment, we do facilitate with pledge. Okay, so a client can pledge his security for a longer term, so there's no change in beneficial ownership, which is one of the concerns of National Treasury. When you do an outright transfer of collateral, all rights and ownership passes in that, and that is a concern. But from a banking perspective, that does enable the new regulation. So that's what we're saying. But you can repost every 12 months, and that is a compromise position that we did propose, is in order to track that, so Treasury can look at, or SARS can look at it, if there's any avoidance, where somebody just leaves a position open to try and avoid tax, GDPR safeguards that you can build in. And also maybe just an observation, the person who has outright transferred his security, there are still arrangements in place where the person who receives the income can still get that income. So the fiscus is not out of pocket on these transactions. And also maybe if I can just use this opportunity, yes, the CTT is a smaller position, and that's more the impact on the person providing you with the security. In the banking environment, it's mainly that interest, so there's no problem from a banking side, it's really the sources of collateral that the concern was.
Well, the next one is LRS tax treatment of the insurance companies with the solvency assessment, right? The next one.
Yeah. I don't think there's a lot of issues here, Chair. Is it?
Does anybody want to say anything? Well, on this one, we more or less, unless something, do you want to say anything to this one? Will you come in so that you can guide us?
Yeah.
It's a technical issue to pick up. So on this one, from what I can see, there isn't an issue, right? So we can proceed. Okay, the special foreign tax credit withdrawal, so to speak. There was a lot of discussion on this one before. Yeah, so what do members want to say? We've heard the argument so far. Is there anything here we have an issue with? Yes, Al?
Chairman, in our discussion yesterday afternoon, there was quite a lot said about the enforcing the agreement, and we haven't technically done it because, you know, I get the impression that there's a view that if you don't get the foreign tax credit, it's lost. But SARS and I assume National Treasury are committed to, once the dispute has been raised, to ensuring that mutual agreement is enforced. And I wonder whether it wouldn't be good to emphasize that here. Am I speaking out of turn, Francis, and your view?
Not at all. That is quite correct. Where these issues have been raised with us, we have been successful in our mutual agreement procedures. Taxpayers, I think, feel to some extent that this is a much quicker option for them because they get to claim it immediately, whereas if you work with a mutual agreement procedure, at least for the first few you are dealing with on a particular issue, it can take a while before you get the meeting of the minds where both parties agree if that is how the treaty should be interpreted and that impact the withholding tax was incorrectly raised. But I think that's a learning curve issue. So once you've gotten through the first one or two of these agreements with a particular jurisdiction, that any further one should go a lot quicker because the principle has been established. And I suspect part of the problem is that taxpayers don't want to be the one or two people who start the ball rolling. And this clearly is a much quicker and easier way to get it. But you're completely correct. Once the taxpayer disputes it in the other jurisdiction, says that's not in accordance with the treaty, and the other jurisdiction turns them down and says, well, we think it is, or what treaty, then it's open to them to raise the issue with us. Then in terms of the relevant mutual agreement procedure article in the treaty, we will raise it with the other jurisdiction, and we will then take whatever steps we need to come to an agreement with them that they need to adhere to the treaty. The question that was raised yesterday was, well, what happens if the other jurisdiction ignores the treaty? Well, then you get to the fundamental question of whether they're acting in good faith. And that was a sustained position across the board with that jurisdiction. You would seriously have to think about whether that treaty should remain in force or not.
everywhere.
But you're dealing with nations, so that would be the ultimate outcome then. Well, I don't think we get there. But that's something that I've never really encountered in practice, and it's pretty rare internationally. It does happen on occasion that parties can't come to an agreement, but that tends to be in other areas, not in something where this is relatively clear-cut.
Sure, you know, I've learned that, you know, our financial matters have a different logic from our own logic, and that's why I've never taken it for granted. I want to understand. You know, if, no, I'm just going back a picture on Sam, on the Sam initiative. If we're saying Sam is going to be, we'll take it back from 2016, but you are then saying, but the international financial reporting standards are only going to come to effect in 2018. Why are we not introducing Sam then? Than introduce it now. I know there might be logical reasons. Like I said, you guys have a different logic from us, and to me, it sounds illogical. Just help me to understand why it's there.
Currently,
I also wanted to know what happens to companies that are not necessarily listed in South Africa, but are listed elsewhere. Would they have any material effect on this?
Currently, in terms of Section 28 and part of Section 29 of the income tax law, when the insurance short-term and long-term do the determination for tax calculation, they do that based on SARS and the actual that is in terms of the numbers. So that is the regulatory framework currently. So now, in 2016, the actuary and the commissioner's discretion is going to fall away because FSD is going to introduce SAM. So what I'm going to say, this is a result of the determination for calculating tax for insurance companies.
Yeah.
So when SAM comes in, the actuary will no longer be required to make determination, and the commissioner's discretion together with the actuary will fall away. So now we are making changes in the Income Tax Act so that when SAM comes into effect, because now in that taxpayer we no longer use the current system of regulatory by the FSD.
Mm-hmm.
So when SAM comes into effect, they won't use it, means that must make provisions for things that taxpayers will be able to use when SAM comes into effect.
Oh, okay. So it does mean that it should only come in. FSD falls off in 2016,
mm-hmm.
but the international standards.
FSD falls. SAM comes in 2016, IFRS comes in 2019, but means that the taxpayers must have something now to use it.
Okay.
Yeah. But Chair, can I just add, look, there's all kinds of international meetings taking place, and certainly with the industry, they want this to come in sooner rather than later, because it's creating a lot of uncertainty. The hope was that we would do it early next year. That bill too will be tabled later this year, but as the Chair has pointed out, I'm not sure and it will have to be passed after the June speech vote, so it would probably be a bit later than late 2016, but you know, it just depends on the legislation.
Okay.
It's called the insurance bill that's coming through.
I thought the bill you mentioned.
Before I forget, I'm just going to remind members that at 12:15 we've got two foreign visitors will be on the 26th vote. So we've got just slightly over sort of 50 minutes, I think. But I think we'll be done by then. You brought in another slide on implementing tax and harmonization of time.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, the next one is the R&D now. Shall we ask Piers to give us a report, because we've met on these issues yesterday, right? Piers, and where we are in that respect.
Yes, I think as correctly outlined earlier in the presentation, this process of brought to attention is at the end. I think we agree that we will just have to wait for, because they are saying the Minister of Finance to system was established. Now today it's still to be established. But then the undertaking is that within 6 months from now, that implicitly is not established. That implicitly is around June next week. We will expect a report from that testing. That testing will deal with all the research and development related issues that has been raised up to, hitherto. And we think that's the process that will give guidance in terms of the definition and other related issues that has to do with concerns raised on this issue. So we then agree that let's wait for the outcome of that process. But for now, of course, I mean, the current provision as provided for in the taxation law, we'll apply. So that's how we approach this one.
Who was there at the meeting?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Who was at the meeting?
Which meeting?
The meeting you had.
The subcommittee meeting.
We will also need to know the composition of the subcommittee. We will need to have the national service to be represented, because they do very represent a different interest.
Yeah, I know, the understanding was
it'll be the stakeholders, National Strategy Staff and the Portfolio Committee with the support staff that's available, Bridget and Peter Paul and Alan and the Pasani. So she starts with this.
I'm not sure if I'm speaking of the same thing, because this, she seems to be speaking of the composition of the taxi that will be reviewing.
No.
The R&D.
No, I'm not speaking of the composition yesterday. So we know what the degree of commitment was.
National Treasury was represented,
yeah.
And also the Parliamentary Management was also there together with official Commissioner Treasury,
yeah.
And the Honorable Liz was there, I was there, Sunisan was there from the budget office. And that was the composition of that.
Yeah. No, I'm saying we were the person that, you know, we paid. You see the guy that keeps coming here and making this case. He said, can't carry on. I didn't say yes or say no or say look in the future. He wasn't there.
So that was the reason of that cabinet. Because we were giving assignment as a subcommittee to deal with concern raised by stakeholders.
Yeah.
And that's what we were trying to do yesterday. But actually that guy is there, we must give him the response of what is our change on matters that is. Because we're going to repeat the same.
No, I misunderstood that. You see, what I thought we were doing is what we did with Makoshi. You know, you brought the stakeholders there last year in Johannesburg, and you brought the department officials there. And instead of a committee, we're going to do the same with the Twin Peaks. So, as I said, other big things, we set up subcommittees. Now, it certainly wasn't my view, but if the majority of the committee feel that way, then there's nothing I can do. The idea was always to include the stakeholder, to include the state officials, hear what both sides have to say, see whether we can arrive at some middle ground. If we can't, then report back to the committee that, look, this issue has been going on for very long. There's nothing we can offer the stakeholders concerned, in this case, the one representing the R&D. So that's what I had intended, but maybe I didn't communicate that. So it means the stakeholder wasn't there, then we're in a slight, well, I don't know. All right, we set up a sort of like, well, can I suggest that either I or Jay will meet with the stakeholder afterwards? And, you know, this meeting is supposed to be in Joburg, as I understood it before we got back, but I think people are very busy. But you know, there is a point that's supposed to have that sort of subcommittee. But I would think that we do what we agreed to, which is have the stakeholder, they hear him out, and then if Jay and myself will agree how we do that. So in our report to Parliament, we say, we have the person, and we have a subcommittee and so on, and goodbye, there's nothing we can do. Or, there's a program of the next 3 years, this is what we're going to do. Or, actually the guy's got a case. So, at most what we can then say in our report is we set a process now, but the process must involve the stakeholder or holder. That's the idea of the subcommittee. I think we misunderstood each other.
But then, if we want to include the stakeholder, because remember, the minister now has instituted the task team.
Yeah.
To look into all these issues that have been raised by the stakeholders.
Yeah.
If we want to include him now, without getting the report from that task team, I don't know how that's going to help the process. My suggestion would be that let's wait for that process, and as we get the feedback from the minister's task team, then we can involve the stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
all right, look, let's talk
outside this meeting. But I think in principle, I would like to suggest that what we do when we have issues in this committee, and we've done it in all the committees that I've chaired, it's something new, and it works remarkably well, which doesn't mean before you misunderstand stakeholders that you get what you want. No, no, no. You get hurt. And we learn from that. But we take our independent decisions. And I really think that's worked extremely well. In fact, it's been remarkably successful, actually. Because both sides, there's no media, they're not posturing, you bring them together, you chair, or you delegate somebody to chair, and you say, okay, let's hear both sides. No, no, no. Five things you come to us with, this one we're agreeing to, this one is no, this is unconstitutional. These two, forget it for the next 10 years. Right? That's the way we do it. So I would urge that we agree with that approach, and I think there's a misunderstanding here. We have to engage with the stakeholders, from what I see, and you know, I know we're all busy, but we'll talk outside the meeting. But you know, what I'm saying in general is that, and we're not going to have endless subcommittees in England unless we get. Ultimately, people are elected to legislate and elected to govern. And government must govern. Govern at the end of the day. Yeah, stakeholders must govern. All right, we will take that forward in some form or another. But for now. Is there anything else on the substance of the issues set out in this presentation by National Treasury and PAWS that anyone's comment on? Yeah, Makosi and then...
Chair, the issue of R&D, I don't want to forget the fact that it's been raised at different fora, especially in the particular committee, with different stakeholders, not just only KPMG. Even during the time when Tech South Africa came to present to us, this is one area they pointed out as one of the key weaknesses, you know, that we don't invest sufficiently or we don't provide sufficient incentives on research and development. And I think we should not lose sight of that. And I think this matter should be, we should elevate it. And I think Comrade is already doing well in that area. And hopefully, the two of you can make sure that as many stakeholders as possible are involved in the process.
Yeah. No, no, I think what I'm saying is that even this and me, we will arrange to meet the stakeholders before we have a report of Parliament. But I think we'll discuss more exhaustively what happened yesterday. But what I'm simply saying is that on this R&D matter,
we have been repeatedly in government and in different parliamentary committees complaining about this issue. From what I can tell, the amount of R&D investment is something that's far below middle-income developing countries elsewhere in the world. In fact, it's very weak in the majority party. There is also an issue raised. I think it's 0.8% and our target is 1.5% and so on and so on. It's a persistent issue, Makosi, not since the first term and different cycle. It's been an issue I remember from the time of GEAR, 1996. And you know, I don't know that guy from KPMG, he may be wrong. He may be exaggerating his case. Let me just tell him, listen, mate, we're not having you back in Parliament to repeat the same thing. You're right, but we're not going to engage with you. It's coming to presentation. We can't carry on like that. So I think between now and the time we write the report, we will seek to engage in some form with him, and then I'll feed that stuff into the subcommittee that I'll engage with him before that. Maybe we can do it together in the next tomorrow or by phone or whatever. We'll find a way. But I think we must, you know, focus on this issue as a persistent theme, because it affects the economy as a whole, and it's a persistent concern of government, parliament, and any and everybody who's got their focus on the country's interest. So, do you want to say anything in regards to some of our observations? Sorry, Dave, let's have Dave, sir.
So, let me take it down by a point or two. We should be very, very cautious that we are not seeing as much as RNG has been raised on various platforms. But for the purpose of this exercise, we are not necessarily dealing with what is allocated to R&D as part of the GDP, or maybe as part of the national budget. We are dealing here with consent that has been raised by stakeholders in as far as R&D taxation incentive is concerned. And if we are to compare how we provide for such in this particular legislation, you will realize that ours is a big general provision. Because if you check those who qualify, and I think Cyril was trying to emphasize on that point, that there are billions that have been utilized as a result of this provision. And I must indicate that if you calculate, we are providing more general than most countries. I think it's calculated at more than 150, I think it's 150% if it's properly calculated. So we need to be very, very careful, because our focus here is on those issues that they raised as stakeholders in the hearing. And those issues are clearly regulated. Among those issues is the recourse when the application is not approved.
Yes.
And then the second issue, which was very, very dominant, was the issue of a duration that is not covered. Because the current provision says, at what time do you submit your claim? So those are the issues that we really need to focus on. And as I'm saying, I think that process that the Ministry has established will help us to provide proper responses to this. Of course, we will engage stakeholders when that particular has been established, is giving us the feedback on these issues at play. Because for now, the issues of definition, how we can define innovation, those things need to be clarified at that level. So that's why I'm saying that's very, very important.
Yeah, I don't understand it, but I'm saying it's about Parliament's role, as I see it, to engage with stakeholders, even with its examples. The point simply is that stakeholder was told, you know, if you look at the minutes, the idea that the members say, no, we don't want to get into your chairperson, and then answer the question, fine, let's leave it. But we gave the stakeholder a promise as well, and we must fulfill that. I don't think there's any justice yet, what process. So I think we will sort this out outside the meeting. But I agree, we don't here as a committee, it'd be presumptuous of us to think we can somehow be dealing with the tax issue. The investment in R&D. There are many other challenges, but this is an issue that does fall within our purview to the manner that you set up and implications for the broader issues of R&D. Can I just move on to the next issue, which is the procedural and legal professional privileges asserted? Now, here, do you members want to say anything, or are we okay with this? There's no issue here that I know of. Is there any issue that National Treasury wants to raise beyond what you said? No. Good. So, Alf, you want to say something?
Chairman, I don't want to say anything about legal privilege, but what I do want to say as a general comment is that really I can't commit myself and my party to anything at this point.
Well, we know that. I mean, that's like a banal. It's like saying I'm in the DA. We know that you're in the DA, right?
Steve, are you cutting my microphone?
Oh, sorry. No, no, we don't. We learned from your predecessors that everything is reserved until. So
that's,
we,
that, yeah. That's the point. And, so when I'm not indicating I want to speak, isn't because I suddenly agree with
you. No, I think you had a run-off.
No, obviously. No, the thing is also, you see, we haven't agreed to anything either. We are just saying tentatively for now for what it's worth. I have three qualifications. I can agree tentatively for now for what it's worth, right? I've been pending the inputs from Dumasani and others, pending also our looking at this thing carefully. So I would like to read it, and you know, I'm sure others do as well. And obviously, you still got to bring those comments to us. So we might change our views between now and then. But on the whole, I think broadly, what we signaling, not a signaling, not agreeing to, is suggestive, not a suggestive help, that we are in agreement where we are and we are not in agreement where we are not. Right? Okay. We also have caucuses and study groups, yes?
No. I'm just to remind you, Chair, that some of us are here to make decisions, others are here to defend decisions.
Yes. I wonder who you're referring to.
Okay, good.
And the next one is the reduced assessment. Right, on this one, anybody wants to say anything, clarify anything, signal where they might be in their current position? Okay, good. Thank you very much. On the issue of reduced assessment, any points, please? Nope. Can we move on then? Yeah, that is obviously welcoming. We have visitors here who can help us with the, make comment, and help us get indeed with the twin peaks, as we call it here, legislation that we're dealing with. In fact, the National Trade has explained that it's been certified yesterday. It'll be tabled in Parliament very soon, and it's going to occupy us quite a lot in the first half of next year. So we would like to learn from experiences. So welcome. We will have you at 12:15 or even maybe sooner, depending on how we progress. Good. Next one is the period of limitations for the issue of assistance. And this we've had quite a lot of input, right? Both last week, last time, and now. Right. Anyone wants to add anything? Comments? Where are we with this issue? It's quite a big issue. What was it?
Which one?
The period of limitations for the issue of assistance.
No, sir, I just wanted to know why suddenly when we are giving this assessment, we are referring to those who committed the commendators, and earlier on we said stakeholders.
Who used the word commentator? It's a
It's a difference in the wording.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, right, yeah. I didn't pick that up, Makoti.
Okay, you've given your answer. Currently, we've had a lot of discussion on this, right? So where are we on it? Anybody wants to say anything? To be honest, you want to say anything? What's your position on this?
Alright, so this thing has nothing to do. I can't get it.
But we are comfortable with the provision.
Yeah.
Because if you look into some of the complex cases that are dealt with globally, but also the complex case, I think there was the one example that was made recently. We think, because we are a bit worried that some of these cases might even go beyond the 7-year limit. And because if they go beyond that limit, we lose. That simply says we can't pursue that matter further. And but we think if you are to compare what is done in other countries, 7 years is an acceptable provision.
When I heard, when we first had this sitting, right? And this one, although I heard the stakeholders, I wasn't convinced with it. I think Sergio, you were right. In fact, if anything, I see this towards what they're saying. I don't know, you know the international thing, I didn't know that. I was lost at some time or another. But actually, I'm not convinced at all on this one. I think this is correct what you're doing. Okay. Then the next one is the liability of third party appointed to satisfy tax debts. Anybody wants to comment on this? Have we a position tentatively yet for now on this matter, or do you want to defer? Oh, yes. Jeff, do you have any view on this one? On this one, do you have any view? About what we should, where we should possibly go on this one? I don't see a problem here personally, but I don't know, maybe others can pick them up. So we're dealing with tax bills, right?
Mm.
And it's very technical, obviously, and so on. And this is like a preliminary list, a hearing, we got one before, and then it will be formally tabled with the budget adjustments next week and all the after, and then we will look at it formally and vote on it. But for now, I think there's nothing I have to raise on this. Okay, then we're done, if I'm correct. Right. Now, what about this? Yes, go ahead, please.
There was an issue that was not captured in this system. That issue of interviews that are being conducted during audit.
Oh, yeah.
And really, as a subcommittee, we said that, that is a norm. I mean, if you want information, how do you negotiate grooming interviews? So we think that provision should be allowed today, or else we encounter a problem where, I mean, our enforcement officials are restricted to interview people to get information. But they must go to the floor and verify some of this information. So we think that provision is important.
Yeah, can I suggest something here? I deeply regret this. My notes are in my iPad, and I would have found that you hadn't discussed it adequately. But to be quite fair, I think what you're saying is correct. A lot of people are saying they shouldn't be subject to considerable scrutiny and you know, they shouldn't be engaged with and so on. But the presenters, as I said, that woman that spoke on their behalf was almost sounding like surrealistic, right? Describing like, you know, people going to the IT kitchen, she had examples of that. Maybe it happened in one company, I don't know. 32 people turning up or something. Unfortunately, I don't have my notes, right? So we asked if you would engage with us, right? And comment down, right? Because if there's any, you know, you see, Mozilla also, when people come to Parliament and they say these things, it's important for government to disabuse the public out there that such is happening. She was extremely evocative, if you remember, extremely, you know, it was like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, I mean, Salman Rushdie type, Kafka, right? You know, she described this thing and it just reached my mind. And I'm glad he has brought it up because he did occupy, and we as a committee at that stage did say that, hey, is this true? And if it's true, it really looks like it's very draconian and unnecessary, and the consumption of your energy and time and theirs. France, you made a very limp reply, right? It wasn't very convincing. So, quite frankly, why have you left it out? Why haven't you responded? Did you actually meet that lady, and where was she resident?
Chair, if I recall, you requested her to provide the details to the committee so that you could have a look at it. No, we have not met with her. What I've done in the interim is I've chatted to our large business centre, and particularly the transfer pricing unit, because they would be one of the prime users of the interview.
The transfer pricing unit that uses it.
Very frequently. Other
Now that's a big issue in Parliament, eh? Now you're getting in. I thought it's the average accusations of errant or whatever, errant behavior. So you were very supportive of that lady. Where did she represent?
Wethu Wentzel.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's the only user, I'm saying it's the primary user.
This is maybe a class analysis. This is give a bias to business, right?
I'm biased
as a chair to the public, whoever they are. It's a multi-class society. People talking, right? But the thing is, what I'm saying is, she was very, impressive in presenting a case. And politics is about perception also, right? Not just influence. And then somebody watched her on TV, or somebody, and I can't only remember this. A number of people that have nothing better to do in life than watch Channel 4 is amazing. Amazes me. Boring stuff. Yeah, because I get these SMSs and it happens like 5 days later I'm wondering how. Like yesterday I met two people and somebody told a friend of mine that, you know, they were very rude about David Mania,
by the way.
I want to say something else very quickly. One day, this was a musical session. No, listen to this. I mean, this guy. So he tells me he's good. I'll treat this
off because he's so sexist. Right? So he says, I've never heard this word from a progressive person. I've been 15, when you hear this word in your life, 15 years old. He says, who's that chick? What's your chemist? You know this guy, by the way, no matter what. Right? Chick. So then he says, no, that's Bocky. Yeah, you know how Indian for that. So I think what she's taking for what it's worth, right? He says, no, not that one, man. I thought the one was amazing. No, that was belonging to his book. You know what? I think that's wrong. He says, no, the other one's in the Indian world. I said, no, why are you interested? Then I said, what are you doing? He says, no, I'm watching the TV last night. What happened to the other two? Because you're looking at the municipal, now I can switch up,
municipal system. Can you imagine watching the TV and then the chairperson saying, should we have in clause 141, subsection B, Roman numeral, should be a may or a must? Then somebody else would say, Charles Zoda would say, no, Comrade Chair, it must be a must. Then somebody would say, no, why don't we say something? Now, unless you have the bill, I have to scan it. Unless you have the bill before you, right? How are you going to follow on TV what we are saying? He says, no, I watch you every night on TV. Then I phone the guy at YouTube. I said, why are you putting us on TV again? He says, no, because the local government elections are coming up. People have a lot of interest in local government. Right? So I'm puzzled. But I can tell you, I think it's a short term of parliament. That's why. A number of people, let's put it this way, relatively privileged people, a fancy part of people. This man comes up to me. One of your constituencies, probably, right? Not that Joe Snowball, he's not a Jeremy Cronin or a Raymond Sutton type. I can tell by the way people walk up, and you can tell who the communist is. So he comes to me and says, sir. He says, sir, I want to tell you, I watch everything I like the way you change.
Nobody makes fun of me.
But they like my sense of humor. So I want to say, hey, why don't you vote for my party? And his wife comes in and she says,
you are not going to believe this, Linda. People have got nothing better to do. Right? But I know a certain party is coming in the first term. I think the party is coming in the first. They just go on and on watching the channel.
Right, okay. Let's go back to the issues that have text and assignments before issuing your text, and I'm going to read your assignments. What did it say on this matter?
Yes, there's no chair. We've got a few slides. So let me start. So Chair, is this to recall, get to the first slide? So you remember that on the 1st of March 2016 is what we call T-Day, when two or three measures happen. The one is that we change the tax deduction for contributions towards retirement funds to 27.5% or maximum of 350,000 rand. The second thing we do is to get provident funds to annuitize. Okay, you'll recall that last year, right at the last minute, in fact it was this session, we brought in that change just to accommodate some of the unions who were resisting or had problems with the annuitization of provident funds. Okay. Even though I think we have enough numbers to show that it would benefit their members if they are in a tax paying category, if they are above the tax threshold, because currently members of provident funds don't enjoy a tax deduction. But as government we say, thou shalt only get the tax deduction if thou preserves and annuitizes. Okay? So no annuitization, no preservation. The where we want to get to is then we shouldn't be giving the tax deduction. Currently we do, to some extent, fully or partially. But we want to move towards that. And what's the point of the tax deduction otherwise? Okay. So we were asked then to, we had asked for a delay of 2 years to 1st March 2017, and I think when the committee also thought about it and looked at the benefits to lots of taxpayers, they in fact asked us to accelerate it and only delay by a year. So not accelerate, only delay by a year, and we were asked to come back and report to you on progress made in that day. So that's what I'm going to do. So basically, and I'm not going to go through all the slides, but part of the reform was driven just from a tax equity perspective, both vertical and horizontal equity, in that obviously your high income earners were getting quite a big tax deduction, and we wanted to limit that to 27.5% or 350,000 rand, whichever is lesser. Okay. So nobody will get a tax deduction beyond 350,000. So even if we weren't doing retirement reform, we would do that. We obviously needed more transparency because there was a lot of tax structuring, and frankly the system was very confusing because it treated contributions to different types of retirement funds, to a provident fund, to a pension fund, to a retirement annuity in different ways. The other objective, of course, was a retirement reform objective, which is largely to get people to preserve. And let me say, we were not in this instance even pushing preservation. We don't like it that when people resign, they cash their pension funds, and Honorable Lee showed me an article today where many teachers were saying that they want to cash in their pensions. Like if you are a member of the GEPF, like all most pension funds, you cannot take your money out But there's a loophole in our legislation that when you resign from work, you can cash it out. We are in fact trying to encourage people to put it into a preservation fund and to change the default on that, but we're not forcing you to preserve. I think we need to do more to force people to preserve, and that the tax deduction should be only given if you are going to preserve most of it. Okay? We can have degrees of preservation, but we're not doing that. We haven't changed anything for GEPF, for example, or for any pension fund, but we were saying we want to just focus on the annuitization part and say that all provident funds will need to annuitize if it's below a certain amount of what? 150,000 rand. So we had increased the threshold as well. Okay. I won't go through all the points, but we put out all the different points here as well. And yes, we were linking to trying to get rid of other complementary measures, like removing the means test for this old age grant, as the soap there in the last line, but as the minister announced, this wasn't immediately affordable. But we were doing that because we didn't want someone who saves, gets an annuity, and then is disqualified from taking an old age grant, because then people feel I'm stupid, you know, I'm saving and then I don't get this grant from government. Okay, you want to not make that effective for people. So, Chair, do you want to go through these the detail? I don't think we've got
time. No, we're looking
for okay. So, and bear in mind, you want to say something? Sorry.
No.
Okay. Bear in mind, we also kept vested rights for provident fund. Bear in mind, it's not 100% annuitization. It's one-third lump sum, two-thirds annuitization. That's the approach that we have with pension funds. Now, when we met with NADLAC, and we've had a number of meetings, they started with the minister when he went on the budget presentation in February. They generally have three types of concerns that they raised last year. I will not get into this. They said to us, you know, workers prefer provident funds. They rightly say, you know, these were the fruits of the struggle of black workers who generally did not have retirement funds and in the 80s sort of won over the right to have some form of retirement contribution. And generally in provident funds, it's the employer who makes the contribution, and often members at the low income end don't make the contribution, so it's directly from employers. And they felt that we were sort of phasing out provident funds. We said all we're doing is we're getting a provident fund with annuitization. If you want to call, you know, you can still keep the name provident fund if it's a meaningful term, but in effect we're saying provident and pension funds will be the same, but we recognize vested rights. Okay. And in any case, we said preservation and annuitization is good for workers, so we could not understand why people not only were silent about it, but actually were saying, don't get people to preserve, or don't get people to annuitize. It just doesn't make sense to us. There was also, at the time, last year, resignations. Now, some from pension funds where people were cashing out, like the article you'll see that's come up today with one of the teacher unions. The problem there, Chair, and subsequently, when we got data from pension fund administrators, we realized it's actually a GEPF problem. And, you know, when we did the presentation on retirement reform, we spent some time on this. And you know, I think that the GEPF never used to sort of really tell us how much you have for your retirement. They started sending these benefit statements. And when you just send it like that, and people say, oh, I've got so much money and I've got huge debt, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, okay? Well, I guess in this case, 1 + -1 = 0, so they wanted to cash in to pay the minus. Okay. And we don't feel this is a problem. Yes, one needs to do a lot of communication with retirement. It's very important for people when you do that, so that there's no misunderstanding. The unions also were sort of saying, during piecemeal reform, you're not proceeding with, we're waiting for the social security paper, which they thought would solve almost all the problems of South Africa. I think we pointed out to them that this is a difficult paper. It looks at to what extent you have grants, to what extent if you have one savings fund, etc., how do these things work, how do you deal with issues that the minister raised in his budget, that you have a surplus in the URF and you have a big deficit in the RAF, okay, these earmarked funds. How do you deal with those? And we felt, in any case, retirement reform shouldn't be one big bang. Treatment is important. And in fact, the only people who gain by delaying reform, retirement reforms, is the industry. That's frankly, to put it bluntly, screwing many members with high charges and so on. And we want to take action, and we don't believe that any delay will serve the interests of workers. So this is what we said. Clearly our arguments, our powers to convince were rather limited. We didn't convince them. Okay. So what have we done since last time? Well, and before that we had 40 meetings with some form of labor representatives on NEDLAC. We even alerted them to the change, and we told them that if you have a problem, if we just increase the de minimis threshold, which is a threshold that says it's currently worth 75,000 rand. So if your pension fund reached 75,001 rand, then you have to annuitize. And given the high charges you have from industry, which we also do need to sort out, so let me say we want to be just as radical on that front. It's quite, we're doubling the limit to 150. And if need be, we could increase it a bit more. And in any case, it would take at least 2-3 years or 5 years, depending on what your income was, before workers would even reach that threshold, given that this was been done from the 1st of March. Again, that was what we thought would come this time round. And in the press release that we put out with the TLAB, we said we would be coming with a proposal on these thresholds. As you saw from today, we've failed to do that. So the meetings that we had with NEDLAC just this year, we've outlined all of those. They were with NEDLAC and with specific unions. Okay, we have some union federations that have informally indicated to us, yes, they were actually disappointed that we didn't proceed last year, that we only consulted one federation, people raised, and that they had prepared their members to take this forward, and in fact are pleading with us not to delay the reform any longer. So I think we are in a bit of a spot, because when we go to in all these NEDLAC meetings, we've been told that they will not talk about it, and we put it to the next meeting. At the next meeting, they say it's the next meeting, but we always get told, no, the social security reform paper is not here, so we refuse to discuss it. Okay. So we've discussed this with the minister. What the minister has decided is that we definitely will proceed with the tax reform on the 1st of March 2016 to implement the 27.5% or 350,000 cap, because we feel. And having had Thomas Piketty, Thomas Piketty here last week, that the equity objectives was outlined in the tax system, and really we can't allow the tax structure. And we cannot understand, we would have thought Labour would be very strong supporters of us moving towards greater equity, and the Minister feels quite strongly that we will proceed with that. There's going to be no delay on that. On the retirement reform, specifically, which is linked to the annuitization of provident funds, the minister feels is in the process of contacting the NEDLAC labour constituency towards the end of next week, because, as you know, he's got a big date with Parliament on Wednesday next week. So he's going to, on the Friday when he briefs NEDLAC on MTBPS. He has requested a special meeting with the Labour constituency to discuss two options. One, which is to keep things as they are and not to amend it and to implement annuitization. Two, to the extent that there are convincing arguments, he will consider delaying that by one, or, you know, a small delay of a year, or two, I guess. But if we were to do that, because we're implementing the tax reform of 27.5%, we will have to introduce a transitional measure to allow for a limited tax deduction on provident funds. So we don't have a pure case of saying no annuity, no tax deduction, because the problem is for many employees or members of provident funds, the employer contribution currently is a non-tax, it's not tax, non-taxable fringe benefit. So if you are even above the threshold, you don't get tax on that. Okay? So effectively you're getting the deduction. But if you make a further contribution, that's from after-tax income. So that is not, you don't get the tax deduction. So if some of the unions are happy for their members not to get the tax deduction, fine. The minister is willing to give them a year to discuss this, but he does feel that it doesn't make sense to delay beyond that. And that's the option that he wants to discuss. Bear in mind that, because what happens now is the employer contribution is going to be taxed in the hands of the employee, okay? Because if you don't do that, I should add that it's not just low-income workers who are members of provident funds. There are many high-income people who are members of have both a pension fund and a provident fund. It's been tax structured so that the entire provident fund contribution is an employer contribution. And so they could get up to, in the new dispensation, if you allow this loophole, up to 47.5% deduction, which is crazy. Okay, we wouldn't be worth tax policy if we allowed that kind of tax structure, and we should give up. We wouldn't be serving the country if we allowed that kind of tax structure. So to mitigate that, we have to, and I'm not going to go into the details, we'll come back to you. We will propose a tax deduction of between 10 to 15% just for that 1 year. We will have to ensure that low-income workers are not hit and sort of allow up to 50,000 rand. And also, with the 350,000, we've got to have to put a cap so that there isn't abuse, because you can't differentiate between low-income and high-income. And we'd look at full vested rights and new transfer regime when a new annuitization is introduced. I don't know, Cecil or Chris, if you want to just... explain that in more detail.
No, I think this is the sort of alternative option that for a limited period share we will preserve a provident fund and then they will have to annuitize. If you do that, you obviously then have to give them a lower benefit, and the lower benefit will be more or less equal to the current employer contribution, which is a non-taxable benefit. And that is really the purpose of this. Obviously, you'll have to adjust the monetary thresholds accordingly, and then in order to have a sort of a blanket relief for people right at the bottom, the monetary cap of 30,000 will supersede the percentage limitation, and that will make just life easier. So this is a sort of an interim measure as a fallback option. And I think that's really... I mean, there are some provident funds that are treated. There's some other amendments that we need to make in terms of cleaning up the system, where some provident funds are deemed to be pension funds. That we are cleaning up in the Income Tax Act, and cleaning up some definitions. I think that's really...
Yeah. And Chair, we deal with this matter in item 2.1 in a more detailed note. We don't go into as much... we don't go in as much detail, but we sort of, you know, we say that the minister is convening the meeting. there are further slides which just show you an example of how it would work. We could explain this more after next week. So once the minister has this meeting, he will make a final decision, and when he tables the bill on the 27th, he will choose between those options. We may actually put it out for comment, just informally, just for technical comment beforehand, to allow for a proper discussion next week Friday. So we thought we should alert you to this.
Thank you very much. Okay, members. Comments? Yeah, yes.
Yeah, as much as I agree with the noble intention of ensuring that people should be there for retirement, I'm a bit concerned as to how do we communicate the impact of such on their disposable income. It was very clear that those are what we call the high-earning categories. We definitely have to talk out more as compared to what they are paying now, which of course is for a good cause. My only concern is how do we ensure that there is a proper buy-in, so as we are not looked at, because we know, I mean, there are perceptions about how national salary is dealing with such issues, how draconian national salary approach. Just to ensure that we don't fall into that trap where we are viewed as people who are not considering. Because I know they are going to take a note in terms of what comes into their pocket. So I think we need to be very, very considerate. Consider an exercise of making them fair so they can readjust their budget in a way. Because this is going to, not the same members of parliament, I think we're going to definitely take some shoes out of the back of their pocket. But for a good cause, I'm not condemning that.
Okay, we need to discuss some matter with your service meeting.
Yes.
But other comments on this thing? This is quite a key issue, politically loaded. In some ways, more politically sensitive than many of the other issues. Anybody else want to comment on it? Okay, well, we won't have the old Tory discussion, right? But I mean, there has to be some sensitivity to the fact that people are resigning because of the huge indebtedness. I mean, you're the people who bring the biggest to us, the horrific rest. And we've discussed this thing before. We had the whole session on retirement reform. You were there, other stakeholders were there. We're not going to cover that ground. The second thing to say is that we hope that there'll be some consensus between the ministry, the department, and COSATU and the unions generally before we formally process this program. Because this thing is really, really going to cause huge eruption. But ultimately we accept that, you know, you have been negotiating, like you told me, some 40 meetings since June 2012. That is remarkable. One doesn't know whether the quantity, what the quality of the meetings were and so on, but still. I will also, in my own way, see if I can't reach out and raise this issue gently with society and see where they are. Of course, there are other unions as well. But I'm sympathetic to what you said. You've been trying so hard to get some agreement. And how far can you go now? You have to be decisive. I understand. But there are also other sensitivities that we've taken into account. So I think this matter, the committee now, has to play its own role to the extent we can. I don't know what it is. So I will also see if I can engage with the minister and see, you know, what we all can do. And if there are members in the committee who feel they can play a role, please come forward. I don't want to say anything about the substance, because we've covered that.
Yeah.
You know, we're familiar with it. It's more about can we at least reduce some of the gaps, we won't eliminate them. I also agree, by the way, that, you know, the publication of the Social Security thing, it's been on our agenda for many years, and we can't wait for that. That I am very sympathetic to. I'm not sure what other things in this field. We haven't fully discussed it, but, you know, I think some of these things. You see, the thing is that, as long as, you know, I don't know how one does it, and so our perceptions, people are not going to listen to your substance of your arguments in a situation like this, unfortunately, right? But I really want to show them that, look, what we are doing now as government and parliament, with parliament also 2 weeks to go, is reasonably consistent with some of the issues that will be taken up in the social security paper. It's an increment. mental approach. Let's say it's still going to be processed. You know, we've got the NHI, we've got the ETOLs, we've got nuclear in some form or another. These are big issues. And you know, you're not going to get a social security paper processed before you deal with it. In the meanwhile, some of the consequences are very bad, and worse than not be. Depending on the strata you are and so on. But, you know, I actually don't know how we politically process these issues. You know, as a committee, I don't know. So maybe we need to apply our minds on a creation of our study group on Tuesday. I think we should get an issue on the agenda because we're going to get lobbied. You know, the last time people were ringing left, right, and center, I remember that in which which I thought was very sensible. But now that it's coming, suddenly at the last minute, you know how people are. So we're all going to get harassed. So instead of waiting for that moment, maybe we see what we can do.
No, John, I wanted to check with the whole draft. Has National Treasury on that stand for impact assessment of the communication. I hear honorable guests, but I want to hear what is in quantifying, you know, what sort of impact are we looking at here? The shift, what is it going to an individual member? What is the likely effect on an individual member?
Can I read something though? We just discussed this yesterday, Makotina. I think that one has to be real. Nobody wants to pay taxes. And I'm sure in other parliaments in the world as well, the legislators, when they decide, look at the national interest, look at all sorts of criteria.
Mm.
But even in the subconscious, they also look at their own situation, the human almost condition. So, you know, the subject of what I was saying is, apart from being harassed by our comrades in consultation, we're going to get a flood of other constituencies raising this issue. So you know, we the politicians ultimately hold us in the committee accountable for what happens. But at the same time, as I said yesterday, and I don't know what this means for anybody, we can't use our own subjective situation as a criteria in determining policy. Whether you're a business person or a sports person or a novelist or whatever, if you are earning an income for a politician of a certain amount, then you have to pay the taxes related to what you earn. It doesn't matter who you are. Similarly, if you're an MP earning very little and, you know, equivalent to other people in other locations that also roads or whatever, then you have to do those exemptions for any kind of, and they accept that. But what we are saying is that you also have to be slightly empathetic to us, particularly to some of these persons whose head is going to get chopped off, right? Not that I am afraid of such things. If the study group is in the village, I'll take ultimate responsibility. The minister and I will be chopped off. We'll probably dare dare think he's going to get away from his head. Minister Nene and me will get our heads chopped off. So I think what Dave is also saying is that it's a matter of educating people.
Yes.
And I think you should consider having a parliamentary briefing.
Yes.
For all parties, so we can negotiate that. Because I think across the party, this will become an issue. So, what I'm trying to say is, we're trying to find the right balance between looking at the objective situation and also recognizing that there are lobby groups here that are going to be sort of probably ignited. But ultimately, look, as far as the committee goes, I will take responsibility. We're not afraid of things. We must just deal with it. Whether you're an accountant or an MP and earning the same salary, you've got to pay the same amount of prosecution. The issue isn't that we ourselves are going to be affected, but also other categories of the emerging elite structure. Now, this issue has been raised. We've been trying to foster some dialogue with the people concerned. We raised it, that there are people who feel I think it's been raised before, right? The taxes are punitive given the historical legacies of the country and the disadvantages that they suffered, and suddenly now, when they're moving up, they're getting chopped, so to speak, with these higher taxes, and others have been accumulating for generations. So, yeah, they have enough to wait. I thought they had. What's the point of making it? I'm making a general point of trying to carry the committee forward and giving some text, because we did discuss it briefly yesterday and she wasn't here, so I'm just partly also addressing it. Okay, no problem.
No, Shemina, my concern was that we had agreed long time ago on the importance of this retirement reform, and now we are at the implementation stage. And we can't backtrack now that we have to implement it. That is why I just wanted to understand what are the fears, what is the impact, because I'm not sure if we are exaggerating the impact or whether it is real or the truth. That is why I was asking.
I'm
not in
exaggeration,
because completely agree, as we said, there has to be an equitable regime.
The media is here, so I never understand it. You know, you can. I'm not saying that, you know, I don't know who's here from where. It's been misunderstood. And I think Dave has put it rightly. Look, we need to educate people.
Yes.
Over to you. And, I'll greet you because I was approached over the weekend. We were not here yesterday. And we should have discussed a little more. So I'll explain to you. I think what you're leaving is more or less, in a way, I'll speak to you after the meeting. So in short, what I'm saying is, respond to the issues.
Okay.
Help, do you want anything to say?
Just over to you. Chair, I think we will be able to give you some numbers from the members. I think the impact from our analysis is that it's going to benefit actually quite a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because we're upping the percentage threshold to 27% to 7.5%, and most people are contributing in the order of 20%, and some many less than that. There are a few people that are contributing more than that, and that we can show you in terms of the numbers. The other issue is the monetary cap that might impact on the upper income group. But there again, one must be very careful how do you pitch it, and the numbers are limited. The other important thing is this particular last slide that we have to look at, is that the base on which we calculate the percentage is now going to be wider. So people are just looking at the percentages. But as a matter of fact, if you calculate the widening of the base with an increased percentage, a lot of people are actually not going to be impacted hard. But we can provide you with numbers and we'll send it to you.
Yeah.
On the just the last issue. On the political office bearers, honorable member there, we haven't got a slide on this yet, but there is a process underway which we can will go deal with that particular issue.
No, what we have done is just with political office and others mandated Dave and me to discuss the issues with them. And that's what we're going to do.
And Chair, in fact, let me just say that issue is dealt with Judge Moeta. So, you know, they are dealing with it because that's more a classification issue and it can actually be sorted out quite easily. I just want to take the other point that Honorable Van Rooyen was saying, which is, you know, for retirement, it's very important that we communicate the message. So once the law is there, communication is going to be essential. This is about educating people, and certainly I think the issue you raise on indebtedness, I think, you know, I've said we would love to come to Parliament and give you a report on the initiatives, and I do think government needs to move faster on that, because there are other steps that we could take to deal with this problem. It's a difficult problem, and I'm sure from our visitors now you may hear about their initiatives also to deal with indebtedness and payday lenders and so on. But thank you.
Can I just say, Peter Paul, can you and Alan sit down? I know the next 2 weeks are chaotic, right? But by, let's say, within 3 weeks, all the decisions we've taken on action, you see what we decided when we had that retirement reform briefing, is that it's not enough just to talk. You've got a whole program, right, that we're going to do things. So can you get that done so then we've got our program? sort of collective bearing that in mind. Okay, let me welcome Mr. Kurt Leutling from the Netherlands Authority of Financial Markets and Ms. Claire Laurie, Financial Conduct Authority of the UK. If you could kindly, what are you saying?
I'm saying.
We need to speak to you, right? So, Kevin, I ask you to come and sit here kindly.
The G10, the biggest financial institutions, insurance companies and banks.
they are covering market share over 80%, and they don't, they sell products, banks are selling insurance products, security products, investments, so you see that it's very difficult. We were having those days a sectoral system that couldn't deal with the market anymore. So the market structure was really changing, and we have to respond. So then you have a lot of models, and we have chosen those days to launch the so-called twin peak structure, which means if you look into this twin peak structure, which is and I think very similar. Yeah, this is a good slide. Very similar to the twin peak system. Both in the SA and the 2016 you are going to launch very soon, is that you have prudential oversight with DNB, and the conduct of business and market conduct is with AFM, it's my authority. Maybe one thing to add is that you start with a legal framework, but you don't start with the oversight system overnight. So that takes really time. You have to change culture within the institutions. And before we got there, for instance, VNB was not VNB when we started, because we had an insurance oversight committee, a pension oversight committee, and a banking oversight committee. So they had to merge. We were, those days, only a securities regulator overseeing the stock exchange. Our mandate was expanded to conduct. So we really had to change our oversight rule those days, and that takes time. So one of my things that I would like to share is that you please realize that starting the system is not a matter of an overnight operation. It takes time. If you go to the next slide, maybe the next one's even, yeah. Maybe it's a little bit too small, the letters there, but it tries to indicate how it's actually organized. So the biggest fear of the market when we started Twin Peaks was that we would have overlapping oversight. Mm-hmm. So we were both knocking on their doors, asking the same questions, because it's completely cross-sectoral. So we are overseeing banks, insurance companies, and DNB is doing too. So you need cooperation. Well, we started with the licensing. You see it's very clear that the licensing by DNB is focused on insurers, banks, money platforms, and so on. We are doing the investment firms and the financial service providers. Then prudential oversight is done by DNB for all these parties. Conduct oversight is done by us for all the parties in the market. Then you have other type of oversight. For instance, are they running a sound and proper business? Do they have the right governance? Do they have integrity efforts within their business? What is their policy towards people, etc.? This is done. We get licensed to investment firms, so we are responsible for this part of supervision within our market. So this is not done by both, this is done by one of the clients. If you move to the next slide, I think this one, there you can see how that works. So we do have one Financial Services Act covering all aspects of oversight, both prudential and conduct. Then it's very clear who is responsible for what. And maybe you have some questions there, I don't have to take them, but
in English.
The Financial Services Act?
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah, no, it's in English. Yeah. It's not a formal translation, don't ask me why, but it's a direct translation. So, maybe what I would like to share with you, based on my own experiences, is that what is really crucial, and we faced that with parliamentary investigation we had, because we had I think we didn't miss that, a massive crisis in Europe with banks, financial institutions, so we had a parliamentary investigation, we had to explain, to be honest, why we failed. And what they said is that the framework is good, so if you consider the Twin Peaks system, it's not an issue, it's more how you operate it. And one of the lessons learned there is that we have to cooperate, AFM, DNB, much more closely. So what we try to do there is that we more institutionalize cooperation between DNB and AFM on board level, on operational level, and even further on, I always say, call it a project level. So for instance, we had a big issue with financial scandal, then we could start a team consisting out of DNB people, AFM people, under kind of combined leadership. This is pretty new, so if you would have said that 5-6 years ago, it wouldn't happen. But that was one of the lessons learned. So you have to cooperate, you have to institutionalize it. And it's also about, in both institutions, you have to closely cooperate also in terms of, is the framework doing what it's promising, to also talk to the Treasury, Ministry of Finance. Let me see if I have one other lesson learned there. And as I said in the beginning, it takes time to start up. You need to find the right people. When we started, we had only 200 people around, very focused on investment firms and the securities business. To change to a economic regulator, you need all the people. You don't need only economists and lawyers. You need a much more broader staff composition. So it takes time to hire the right people, to have the right DNA. And I think one, and that's of course my perspective, and also because we are here with FincoNet, I think in a Twin Peaks system in general, there is more focus on consumer protection. That's what I learned if I compare to other European countries, because you have this conduct operation within your committee. So by nature, that is just consumer-centric focus. So that's one of the other, I would say, very positive elements within a country.
On this
thank you very much. I was very, very pleased to hear, and appreciate the invitation. Apologies that I don't have any slides, I'm afraid, but I can send you any further information that may be helpful. Twin Peaks in the UK is similar to the Dutch model, but there are some differences that perhaps it's helpful to compare and contrast. Just to give a bit of background, we moved to Twin Peaks in the UK in 2013, following the financial crisis that was felt in Europe. We had a new government, and their view was very much that it's really hard to do prudential regulation and conduct regulation at the same time, because as soon as there's a big problem in one area, all your attention goes to that, and then the other area may get forgotten, and then a few years down the line, you realise there's a mistake or something. So to be able to do both aspects of regulation well, the feeling was very much that you need two separate regulators. And also I think recognition that actually the skill set needed to supervise firms for conduct purposes or prevention purposes are often quite different and take people with different backgrounds and different experience. So we moved to Twin Peaks, but we have a hybrid form of Twin Peaks really. It's not so such an easy fit between prevention and conduct. So it's perhaps helpful if I describe the structure a little bit. We have our Treasury Department, which has overall responsibility for the financial sector. And the Bank of England is the central bank and has been for many years. The Bank of England also now has responsibility for supervising and regulating payment systems, so that the kind of the plumbing and the network that supports the payments in the UK. In 2013, a new regulator for prudential supervision called the Prudential Regulation Authority was established, and that is part of the central bank. So they're in the same building, and they shut off, and it's very much within the central bank's arena. The FCA is a conduct regulator, but we're also a prudential regulator. And we merged out of the previous Financial Services Authority, which was the UK's one single regulator. We also have a committee called the Financial Policy Committee, which has responsibility for trying to manage the systemic risks in the system, so which the FCA and the PRA are both members of. It's perhaps easiest to describe what the PRA does and then explain that the FCA does everything else. The PRA is responsible for the prudential supervision of any firm that takes a deposit in the UK, so banks, credit unions, building societies, insurance companies, and some of the very largest asset managers if there was a problem with one of them, that they would really have a big impact on the UK market. The FCA does pretty much everything else, so we're responsible for conduct supervision of all firms, but also for prudential supervision of firms that are not prudentially regulated by the PRA. The PRA regulates about 2,000 firms for prudential matters, and the FCA has everybody else, which is about 70,000, but of course a very small one. a loan, where if there was a problem, it wouldn't have a big impact on the market. Since we adopted Sean Hughes in 2013, the FCA's responsibility has been expanded, so we now have also have responsibility for all consumer credit supervision and regulation. So credit cards, car financing, any form of credit to consumers. And I'll say a word about payday lending, which is a real top issue in the UK in a minute. And last year, we also established a new payment systems regulator. So whilst the banks are going to have prudential responsibility, there's now a new regulator, which is part of the FCA, that looks to promote innovation and competition in the payment systems sector. That's the structure. But of course, it's just as important is to change the approach that we brought in when we moved to Twin Peaks. So the FCA aims to be much more of a forward-looking, judgment-based regulator rather than relying on rules and detailed standards and guidance all the time. Because of the expanding remit, it's really important to mention that we are risk-based. So the firms that have the biggest impact on our market and have the most customers or the most amount of assets, they get the most amount of attention. And so we have a graded system for supervising these firms. And prioritisation is really, really key. And that's something we're trying to focus on at the moment and do better. When also we started with the FCA, we brought in some new ways of supervising these firms. So we now do a lot more thematic work and looking at issues across the sector as opposed to necessarily with one specific firm at a time. And that's a way of kind of trying to change the behaviour in the market without having to go through a very expensive and time-consuming enforcement action or detailed supervisory work with every single firm. And we also now do what are called market studies, which aims at looking at competition in particular sectors and seeing whether competition, let's say in the general insurance market or in credit cards or bank accounts, is really working effectively in the UK and is having a positive impact for consumers. In terms of coordination with the Bank of England and the PRA, as Gert said, it's really important. We have a number of mechanisms for doing it, both at the senior level and also at the kind of operational level. So firstly, our chief executives are members of each other's board, so the FCA sits on the PRA board and the PRA sits on the FCA board. And they have quite a formal structure of quarterly meetings to discuss matters of coordination, whether that's supervisory work with the individual firms or whether it's about the UK's position on international issues, those sorts of things. As we said at the start, we're also both members of this financial policy committee, which is charged with identifying risks in the system. At the more operational level, we've got various mechanisms for coordinating, and we need to because firms have to just authorise once in the UK so they have a licence to do their business. And so the FCA and the PRA need to coordinate on that to make sure we're both happy to provide the licence and that we have no concerns about the business model and their operating strategy and those sorts of things. And we work together on some supervisory work, although I think it's important to say we don't coordinate with each other when it comes to going to the firms themselves and doing the on-site visits. So it is possible that they could have two separate visits on the same day from the FCA and the PRA. And that's because we've got very different things we're talking about, looking at very different issues and risks. So we don't do joint supervisory visits together. We have a formal memorandum of understanding which sets out all the requirements about how we have to coordinate together, and that's refreshed as well. In terms of the agenda for the FCA over the last 2.5 years and going forward, as I said, consumer credit is a new responsibility, so that's something we're spending a lot of time and attention looking at. And we had a big issue with payday lenders, so consumer credit firms that provide very very high cost short term loans or really, really high interest rates. So we've taken some action there and actually put a cap on the limit of interest to be charged to protect consumers from these practices. Pension reform is a really big topic in the UK as well at the moment. We've just had some changes in our pension market, which means people who are retiring now have more freedom and flexibility to decide what to do with their retirement income than previously. And we spent also a lot of time looking at the financial advice market and whether or not that is working effectively for consumers. In terms of our experience with this week, I think the Netherlands has got 10 years, but we've only had our model for 2.5 years. So it's perhaps a bit too soon to be able to comment on what works effectively and what's perhaps a weakness. But I would echo Greg's point that coordination between the two authorities is really important. And because we are still relatively new in our structure, we know people at the PRA and they know people at the FCA and we can pick up the phone. I think formalising that will be a really important test of time in the future.
Thank you very much. Over to you. Questions, comments, anybody?
No, I just wanted to find out how are they managing the transition of pure legislatively, because you will obviously, especially in your hybrid state, because you are increasingly probably Dutch, having been there for 10 years, maybe they can share as well. How do you manage the legislative processes during the transition of pure?
Okay,
so we take several questions at the same time. Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Just one of the concerns that has been raised here has been the intrusion into businesses that is anticipated. That's the question. The regulation of conduct in terms of, let me give you an example, the insurance, part of the insurance industry is claiming that, you know, we're going to now standardize on policies and innovation in policies is astounding because the policy context is going to be regulated. What is the experience both of the Netherlands and the UK in the market acceptance after seeing it in practice rather than think anticipation?
Okay. Maybe I'll just give a quick context. Like we heard only this morning from this time that the bill has not been certified by the state law advisors. It will be in the parliamentary circuit the next 2 weeks at the most, right? And so for us this is an initial quarter, it's very new to us. I mean we understand aspects of the system, but as we're looking at certain things, we will only do so in a concerted way in the next 6 months. One of the things that I wanted to ask both of you is, probably in the Dutch case, is yourself. Since you had a Synthes model introduced, what has been like, are there any signs of consumer awareness that's more pronounced now? Do you have a system where people come to you with their problems and are you seeing more people coming to you? So in other words, ultimately, as I think you just said, the issue is to protect the consumer. That's the ultimate aim. And to what extent is that happening? Especially in Europe, UK I think is doing well, you know, compared to what you were, compared to Europe. But especially in Europe, I mean, given the current state of the economy and the indebtedness and so on, it's very important. So that's one of the issues. The second is, in the Dutch case, I didn't get a clear sense. Maybe if my mind drifted for a moment, but you can give you answer the question. Shall we go with and I'll ask you something what you said. The researcher, you went to note every little word in the corner that you said. So I don't know for the meeting, but I got a slightly better sense anyway, listening to the UK experience of the coordination, the people serve on the same board, you know, meeting. What's the case in the Netherlands? Thirdly, you know, I mean, when you spoke, both of you, I was a bit surprised as well as to the overlap with our own issues, despite the different cultures and histories and economies. I was a bit surprised. I mean, you know, like you're talking about the short-term lenders and so on. It's a big issue here. In our country, it's mostly the poor who bear the benefit of the disadvantages, who say who often don't have the option to sell it to people like I do to go to banks. So that's interesting, that even in a literate economically more literate society, if you are about to get where it goes, people are victims of this. So there are other things, but I don't feel at this stage, you know, I was just the initial sort of feel for the thing. I might mention to you, since you're from the UK, we did speak yesterday, we have applied to Parliament to do a study to a partly prompted by the National Treasury. We have approached Parliament, they in fact, National Treasury suggested that we visit the Netherlands as well. But some of us felt that we should look at a developing country also. So at this stage we've gone to Parliament and said to them, not only go to Mexico and the United Kingdom, but Parliament has got problems about that. One is financial, two is there's a local government election coming, and people feel, you know, for a lot of reasons, they're not a good at it. So we are negotiating with Parliament here. So if it's possible, we might come to the UK in the next, if it's possible, towards the end of this year or sometime early next year. Not sure whether we will. But even if we don't, I think through the internet and all of the people to communicate, and Dresani and the team will engage with you. So see this as part of an ongoing discussion. And especially if you haven't any plans to go to the Netherlands, we would like to engage with you. So our researchers will connect with you. So if you can kindly give Dresani your contact details. So I'll stop for now. If anybody else has to raise anything before you come back. No.
On the question of the transition during the legislative process, our piece of legislation passed the Parliament relatively quickly, actually, and then we had about a year or so to prepare for the change within the regulators. What we did was, within that time, we split first internally into what the model would become. So we had the FSA, the Financial Services Authority, was the one regulator up until 2013. But for about 18 months before some weeks, we divided ourselves internally into the future structure. So that helped us in test out some of the points of coordination, and it made people be clear on what their role was on day one. So that was really, really helpful.
Well, the only thing I can add there, because I know that we discussed with your authority how you could do this transition period, and we understand these plans. I think this is really good, it's really working, that you kind of start acting before it's really there. For us, it's too long ago. It's like 10, 12 years ago. I wasn't even there. I was, in those days, I was a banker. So long time ago, I can't remember, but I remember that we discussed it, and I think this is could be a way to go, that you start right away.
How long did it take the British Parliament to pass the vote, the 26th vote in the Common Act?
They take less than 1 year for every bill, because if it's not passed, then it has to go up again. Maybe 9 months, maybe?
9 months. And the Dutch?
I can't recall, but I can look it up.
No, it's fine. I'm addressing you, partly, because, actually thinks, I'm going to use this against that pressure there. He won't want to be his own way. He wants us to have public hearings tomorrow, finish the bill by Monday, and it's done. Because he wants to get it, I know, he wants to start implementing. But if the British and the Dutch are taking 9 months or so on, how many years of parliamentary democracy? 600,000 years? And you've got about 600,000 years, and we are how many years, 21 years? Work that out. You did a professor of mathematics. So we should see how many years to do this stuff. Right. So back up, 6 months to a year probably in Holland as well. Okay, go ahead.
The question about the acceptance, the pushing back of the market participants, it wasn't a bit there when we started. Though today we are living in a different time. So we had the crisis. In terms of the intrusion of conduct, we don't have to explain that it's necessary. This argument about inflation, not so good I would say. I think that also depends on how you respond to it. So what we did is we are not approving financial instruments. So they can't come to us and say, well, we have a new financial instrument, our engineers, they made it up, and we have to stand it. We don't do that. It's your responsibility, it's at the company, So we are not developing product, but we are looking into your product governance process. And if you cannot explain that a certain product is suitable for a certain client, you have a problem. Then we can either ban the product, either you have a fine or whatever. So in terms of innovation, no, we try not to hold up innovation. We are looking into product governance. We are having this Student Customer Value Program, and every year we make a presentation, a public presentation on how they are doing. And as long as we still find areas in which the criteria of Student Customer Value is not very convincing, they're not pushing back, because they know there are still areas we should provide better information, develop better products. And the other thing, that's my last point, is what we still see is that their strategy and policy and annual report, fantastic in terms of treating customers fairly, fantastic. How come that then the outcome is still not there? So that's another thing we are challenging them. On paper it's all there, but still we find products, if we look in certain areas, that are not meeting the treating customers fairly criteria.
We also have a product intervention that we don't pre-approve. I think some market participants would like it, because then it's a bit of a takeover, but we don't do that. But we can ban a product growth if it's not suitable. On the question of consumer awareness of the regulators, but also consumer financial literacy, I think consumer awareness of the FCA has increased. One bad reason. We've recently started running a consumer campaign, so kind of communications campaigns targeted at consumers. And our first one was on investment scams, and so that ran in local papers and on the radio and advertisements. And I think that helped raise some awareness of the FCA and what we're all about. Another reason why I think they know about the FCA but it's bad reason is because we've had a really big problem with a product, a payment protection insurance product, that was mis-sold, really widespread in the UK. So sold to people when they were buying another product, maybe an insurance product or an investment, and they didn't need this product. But they weren't told down the phone by the advisor who was really pushing this product on them, and millions of people were sold it. And they're now, this was what I found out, and they're now claiming redress from the industry. And I think there were some figures just this week about the number of people in the UK who've received a text message or a phone call from a claims management company saying, you potentially be in this old BBI, get in touch and find out for those money. That's actually helped to raise awareness, but for a wrong reason, unfortunately. But I think it's important to say the FCA actually, which I think is unusual compared with other market conduct regulators, we don't have an objective or a responsibility for promoting consumer financial literacy or financial inclusion. We have a separate organisation in the UK that does that. It's called the Money Advice Service. It's an independent authority that tries to promote consumer financial literacy. So that's not something that is within our responsibility.
Yeah, we do have exactly the same situation. So financial education is not with us. It's with a separate body. And the good news there is that they try to start in a very early stage. You need to start at primary schools if you want to be effective there. So it takes another 10, 15 years, but this is the right time for it. It's not with us. Complaint handling is the same. Go to another one. And I have to say that, to be honest, consumer awareness is a very difficult area. And why? There's actually two elements there. One is, we found out with some other academics and conduct regulators that consumers are not behaving rationally. So we have all the laws are based on rational decisions. So that is an issue. And the other thing is what we see with financial products. They really don't care. So if you, for instance, the average man spends 30 days buying a car, selecting his car, and 2 hours for his mortgage. So that's different. Then maybe a corporation.
We are a bit different. Go ahead.
Yeah, then your specific question on that is how did we organize the corporation. So we have a financial stability committee, which is really focused on financial stability. with the DNB, AFM, and the Treasury on board.
Yeah,
is that true? And then we have organized frequent meetings, so we don't have the situation where we have a board member from AFM in the board of DNB and vice versa.
No,
we don't have it, but they meet every, I think, 3 months. The board they meet, and we have a, and I didn't mention that, we have a steering group. I was part of that until 1 year ago with senior management, talking about all the elements that are not working well in cooperation. So people can come to you and say, well, I'm trying to do something with this bank, I need DNB for that. They're not willing to exchange information, how come? And then the steering group has to find out what's happening and how to solve it.
We got lunch for half an hour. Everybody got cozy. We're not have known that we got lunch now. We're upstairs on the second floor. We've got half an hour there, and then I'll be checking at 1:30. Well, thank you very warmly for coming at such short notice, and you delivered some very helpful insights to us. Obviously, we will get a firmer grip of the issues that we showed there. Well, I'd be interested in how you raise your parliament, we come across with our national parliament. Can I just make one announcement very quickly? I mentioned there's this conference in Paris on Monday. I hope you don't know, there's an, you know, the OECD, I think it's the UNSA, right? So you suggested me because they keep ringing me and checking, I don't know where they got the details from. I think one of your delegates went to the OECD thing. But they had a meeting, I think you might have seen in the Mail and Guardian last week, and passed guidelines on base erosion and profit shifting. So I think it's very good. What they've decided, Momo, is the decision taken by government representatives and the security body must be discussed by MPs. So there's an OECD parliamentary forum, I didn't know it existed, which is meeting on Monday to discuss the main issue there is base erosion and profit shifting. So when I got the invitation, I asked the powers that be to, because we're a three-person commission, to ask for the chair of the DGI, chair of mining, or their representatives to also come. Parliament has all issues about that. I said, no, the finances just go. So I'll be going on Monday. It's a one-day thing. I'll be flying back immediately after you finish. I'm flying back the same night. So I'll be back at work on Tuesday. But I'm going to get it sorted out in the next few days. I haven't got a visa yet. But if it gets sorted out, I think it will, then I will be here for about 2 hours of the meeting. I'll be at 11, if I'm correct. At the airport. So they will be taking responsibility for the committee. But as you know, suddenly nothing else changes. I'll talk about this. I'll do everything but my role, whatever I'm supposed to do in consultation with him, the editing and all that. There's emails, internet, iPhones. I can do everything. Nothing will change. It is that Des will chair the meeting, but since he'll be chairing, I will confer with him all the time. So all the reports you send to me, send to Des at the same time, and then you'll confer the report. So I'll be away for about 2 hours on Tuesday. From the committee. Well, I'll give you that. We have a talk about quarter to 12, realistically. Okay. The next thing to say is that can I get now a commitment that in some form or another we communicate to Parliament that this thing of meeting in the fourth quarter on the 12th and passing all the beautiful hours is not going to happen? Anybody have a problem with that? It gives me a mandate to go and negotiate. It's not tenable, maybe. I'm not the only one complaining. Is there anybody who's got an issue with that? So I don't negotiate. You can't get good. I mean, this is poor fellow with Bridget, you know, sorry about in-house battles, but it's important to win as a human person, you know. And this guy, old friend, Ellen, we can't do it. He's doing all the reports, actually, quite from one. I have already sent you the report on Land Bank, which I think is a very good report, by the way. I've been able to do that. It was sent to your emails last night or this morning, is that right? So can you look at that and comment on it? It's nothing controversial there. Can you put your comments in tracking by today, tomorrow, 12 o'clock, so I can work on it. The other thing you're pleading for, so the Jumasani's first draft is more oriented to the committee's concern, is can you please comment, as we agreed on Tuesday, nobody has, on what you think the committee recommends in respect of National Treasury and SARS, so the sittings we have on Tuesday. And yesterday, the County Standards Board is not much to say. So please, comment on the Land Bank. The one thing I would like to suggest, given the quality of the FSC report, and given how hard it's going to be to redo everything, and I wasn't even here that day, I don't know whether we have to do that, or we can leave it as a report that we process early in the year.
tangent thing. We were mentioned a tangent thing, and the tangent thing being a bit of a report. So the BRRR, National Center in Charge, Land Bank, Accounting Standards Board, and possibly the FSC. It's going to be a big report. I would propose to bring it out. So, colleagues, please, with internet, iPhone, and whatever, Samsung, it's easy to comment, really. Because on Tuesday we have to vote. There's not really much time. Any guidelines or comments or generic points you want to make or specific points on preparing the report? Anybody got anything to say? No. Okay, thank you all. We're getting upstairs to the second floor.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you.
Drop me an email. We've got to go from there. Also, if you have some more legalistic questions, I will find the right people there. Our transition process. Yeah. But I think that in terms of transition,
I think I had to manage to come here without bringing any witnesses.
Well, I was in there.